eloquently than we can. And he's got all of this other psychological background to kind of give it a little bit of weight.
Yeah, the clinical aspect.
People are trying to say that he's a philosopher, and I don't think that that's appropriate. I think he's more of like a social psychologist.
Right.
He is a psychologist first, and he has all this other stuff that that his psychology has informed as he has, you know, developed his own worldview. That's another thing I like about him is he strikes me, I don't know his total life story, but he strikes me as a guy who just sat down and he had studies.
Right.
He researched what he was interested in, and that took him in a specific direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like objectively looked at stuff, and he ended up being more or less a libertarian as a result.
Yeah, he's trying to find the truth and ascertain what's real.
And like we say, and he would probably be upset if you said libertarian because he's so against ideology.
Right.
But like, it seems like his worldview maps pretty well with the political aspect of libertarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And
at least the self-reliance part anyways. Yeah.
And it seems like he got there through avenues that no other libertarian that we know really goes through.
Right.
You know, we're used to seeing, it was Ron Paul, and then I read stuff from Rothbard or Mises, or I read stuff from Horowitz or whatever.
Right. He didn't come at, he came through it through politics, through free speech, but
I think like, originally he, it was anti, he was, he read, I, it sounds like based on his lectures that he read the Gulag Archipelago
mm-hmm.
by Solzhenitsyn or whatever, which is on my reading list now, 3 volumes, hooray.
Right.
He read that, and he got, that really pushed him on the anti-communist stuff.
Right.
And he was, but he also talks about how he was interested in how normal people could be, could work at Auschwitz. Like, he's like,
yeah.
How could a normal person do that? And, of course, that informed much of his politics as well, going down the anti-collectivism route, I guess. But nevertheless, it seems like he just sat down over his life and tried to figure out how to live, more or less. And he ended up...
I'm just trying to live! That's all I'm trying to do is just live and get to the bottom of things.
But
he's like a little Paul McCartney mixed with Kermit the Frog. I don't know what to do. I'm out with the boys in the cavern club, and there I am, and I'm just, my mind is blown. It's so surreal.
But anyway, like, what really upsets me, though, is, one, that he's associated with the alt-right at all.
Yeah, he shouldn't be.
He shouldn't at all. Like, everything that he says, the only reason the alt-right likes him is because he's so vehemently anti-communist.
Right.
They're very anti-left-wing totalitarianism, even though they're more totalitarianist authoritarian. They're more authoritarian than they would like to admit.
Right.
You know, they try and pretend that they're not, but they are. And he would be against all of that. You know, he hates fascism, as far as I can tell. He hates fascism just as much as he hates left-wing socialism and stuff. It's just, he thinks that he probably speaks out more about the anti-communism stuff because academia is so littered with people that are sympathetic to communism,
right.
But they are obviously against fascism. But he only gets associated with alt-right because alt-righters get him on. But they don't really go much deeper than that. It's very clear that they don't go down the hole very much because the minute that you actually pay attention to stuff he says beyond his strictly political lectures, you realize that he's actually anti-ideology altogether.
Right.
He's not for any kind of collectivist identity in any way, shape, or form. So, like, if you have any idea of associating any kind of motivation with people based upon anything that's more than individual and more than, like, how that individual has interacted in a social sense, how they've developed their own identity throughout society, like, he would disagree with you vehemently. And I feel like the alt-right does not. I mean, like I said, I've argued with a lot of them. They're straight up like, if you're white, then you're smarter.
Right,
you're white.
Yeah. There's a deficiency if you're, if you run, yeah. I mean, how many alt-right people have you actually talked to, Galt?
If a person voted for Trump, are they alt-right?
No.
Oops. Man, I accidentally uploaded a We Are Libertarians thing to the Bob and Tom Snapchat.
Probably 0.
Oopsie. Missouri.
He also is very good at making you realize how dumb you are.
Maybe over the internet, but not that I knew their name.
I've met a few, and the alt-right guys, they're something else. Definitely racist. Okay. Yeah, I wonder how he did that.
Yeah, I mean, I followed the fall of Cantwell, and I had followed him for a long time before happened, so.
He's a great example.
Yeah. That was enough for me to know to stay away from all that.
Yeah.
HBO did a good job.
I wonder how do you get into that kind of position? Like how it seems, at least as far as I've noticed, it seems like they came about it from a defensive kind of thing. Like they've spent all this time being told that they're worthless because of their skin color.
Right.
And as a result, they reflexively go to the opposite end of the spectrum to say, no, I'm the best because of my skin color.
Right.
When the reality should be, let's be honest, skin color doesn't actually matter as much as you both make it out to be.
Right.
And, you know, we're all people, we're all individuals, and I don't know. That's the impression I've gotten.
Galt Lives Matter. Okay, you guys ready? Oh, shit. Shut up, Mevo. Okay, here we go. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. We bring you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves while putting people before political parties. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective with the goal of leaving you better informed. Please be sure and rate and review us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and subscribe on Patreon at WeAreLibertarians.com. In exchange for supporting our program, we give you all kinds of bonus content and free stuff. You would have heard a Jordan Peterson rant at the very beginning of the show by Creighton Harrington. I rolled tape before we started, so you get to hear the beginning and the end. You get to hear...
I wouldn't say rant.
Yeah, you were walking us through Dr. Jordan Peterson.
It was a talk about.
And, you're going to have to talk into that mic louder there, buddy.
It was a talk about.
And you get to hear it in without commercial, high definition, CD quality audio. Yes, my smooth pipes. What could you ask for better than that? This show is crowdsourced, so you can send us news with the hashtag WALNews or in our Facebook group and Discord channel. We're always taking your questions and comments via email at editor@wearelibertarians.com. Please be warned that this show is raw, unedited, and authentic. So the language is sometimes strong and offensive. Joining me today are the original co-hosts from the 30s, the 40s
Woo!
Episodes, the first few. Creighton Harrington, you're first. How are you?
Very good.
Thank you for joining us. he's wearing a Public Enemy Fight the Power t-shirt and a Han Solo jacket.
Well, I'm not wearing the jacket right now.
All right. And Chris Galt, how are you?
Oh, I'm a dreamer.
We're all dreamers now, aren't we, Chris?
Oh, yeah.
You came in with a little pep in your step, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Your buddy Trump.
Great week. Don't you feel inspired to be an American right now?
I always feel inspired to be an American. I don't need a politician to do that for me.
Man, but it feels good when one does it for you.
All right, we'll get to that. We're going to talk.
America.
He's got a different idea for what the tone of the podcast should be. He's got like a late night. What's the
smoking jacket?
The ladies' man?
Right, yeah. Right? He does kind of have that ladies' man robe on.
Get some Cavassier and put on an afro over here.
Yeah, I wore shorts the last 2 weeks, but it is too cold today.
Yeah,
sweatpants.
I don't even sweatpants. Yeah, Galt, you strike me as a sweatpants.
They go under the table. Nobody can see anyway.
I'm wearing basketball shorts too. See? Yeah, I'm wearing my nice maroon shirt with my fresh fashy haircut.
You didn't leave the house at all today, did you?
Oh, no, I went to work. Yeah, I had a very productive day. Very busy day. Very busy at work right now, which is not good for you guys, but good for work. So, so good times. Thanks for joining us. If you didn't listen to the last week's episodes, got a lot of great feedback. I personally think that the previous episode, 262, was the best episode of We Are Libertarians ever. So thank you to my two co-hosts. That was definitely a great episode.
Like a week ago today?
A week ago today. Oh. Yep, the Jordan Peterson episode. Oh. I thought that was very good, and the one before that was good, too.
We did a... Yeah, I meant this is the hat trick, ain't it? Three weeks in a row?
Yeah.
How long will you be in town?
A week from today is the 7th or the 8th, so I'll be here for that.
Okay,
one.
All right. Maybe we'll do a
next week
a four way.
Ooh,
what's a four way at Steak and Shake? It's that chili.
What's it
cheese?
Called when you get four strikes in a row?
Certain death. All right, so so yeah, that was
not
the,
baseball. Yeah.
No, in bowling. Oh.
It took 262 episodes to do the best one ever. We're 1 minute in, we've already succeeded in not making this
the greatest.
This is not going to be the best episode.
Well,
ever.
You can't. We started off on a great foot last week because we started with Kermit the Frog singing in the pond. So we're not gonna be able to top that beginning.
Our Patreon subscribers, you get a bonus feed, an RSS feed that has all the bonus content and all the shows unedited, because I literally just take them off the recorder and load them up to the Patreon. I don't edit them at all.
I used to
spend
cut out people's
hours.
Curse words and stuff.
Curse words, breaths.
He would literally like he'd look over at the timer and he'd just like make a little note on the time because he'd had to do so much editing before he uploaded it. Sometimes it'd be like a week before the freaking episode got up.
This show was so much more professional back then.
We tried really hard.
And I would mostly do it to make myself sound good because I hate my cadence, I hate my voice, I hate everything that comes out of my mouth. And I would go in and cut out and all that stuff. And I just don't anymore because that's not how people talk. That's not how I talk. That's not how you guys talk. And I want this to reflect friends sitting around a kitchen table, although who sits around a kitchen table? Friends sitting around a couch talking.
We are
talking.
Sitting around a kitchen table.
Yeah, we are, but you're not supposed to tell. They're supposed to think on the YouTube that this is like a high-quality studio desk.
It's a kitchen table that you got a cheap tablecloth from Party City for.
Right.
It's a high-quality tablecloth, I think.
It is. I put some plastic, some PVC over it, so I wiped it
he
down.
He laminated it.
Yeah, I wiped it down before you guys got here.
I get
with
it.
With your body?
It's dirty, but I get it.
No. It was cat footprints. You guys are perverts.
Yeah.
All right. So, very good, guys. Let's jump into it. Let's do general impressions. Donald Trump gave his first State of the Union. This is the second time speaking in front of Congress. Last year, he did an address to Congress. It wasn't an official State of the Union, but this was his first official State of the Union, and let's give initial impressions. Chris Galt, what did you think of Donald Trump's State of the Union address?
So I'm a big believer in the parallel universe theory, right?
Okay, explain.
So I feel really, really bad for all those people in the other universe where Hillary Clinton's given her State of the Union. Because it would have been the least inspiring speech in history, and I think this was the most inspiring speech that I've lived through.
Right.
It was definitely Donald Trump's best speech politically.
I think it was Donald Trump's best moment politically ever.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
He focused on things that are all American, In God We Trust, standing for the flag, all these heroes that stand up for our country. It was just the most patriotic thing I've seen since before Obama, since like 9/11.
I'm overflowing with patriotic mucus right now.
Right, yeah.
It was really good.
I'm just full of patriotism.
So that's my first thoughts. Libertarian and issues-wise wasn't that great. I mean, we did, 2.4 million new jobs, right?
Yeah, but there was also $3.1 trillion in new deficit spending that he wants to...
Yeah, he's not good at... How do we go to from the largest tax cuts in history to increasing all the spending?
Yeah, well,
it's always something that
it's called a Republicans in charge
because there's countries to blow up, yo.
Right. Yeah. It's like the seventh largest tax cut in history. It's not actually the largest tax cut in history, but Donald Trump again thinks that if he says it out loud, that's the truth.
Right. Didn't he say that he had the biggest viewership of any State of the Union?
Which is not true either. Yeah. Like that, it would, even if there were 48 million people watched it, so that's still a significant amount of people. They watched it on TVs. That's not counting the streaming. I mean, think about yourself. I didn't watch it on TV.
I did.
Really?
I work for Xfinity. I use X1. In voice remote, you can just say State of the Union. And it changed the channel for me.
But did you watch it on cable?
Yeah, if you're interested in that, you can go to Xfinity.com.
Right. They're not paying me. They may be paying you.
No, but yeah, I watched it on actual cable.
I watched it. I watched it on Fox News. A YouTube stream. Yeah, I think I watched it on the Fox News app.
Okay. I think the app views actually started counting now.
Oh, dude,
I think those actually count now for
Hulu.
It's on Hulu.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. It's on everything. Now, Creighton, where did you watch it at?
I didn't watch it. Because, I mean, you've seen one, you've seen them all.
You've never seen Trump's State of the Union. You've never seen anyone like Trump in office before.
So what?
No, it's not going to be the same. Nothing he does is the same.
The nuances amongst these things don't excite me in the way they used to.
Right.
It's more or less the same thing. It's, you know, one group's in office, and they're talking up all the things they want to talk up, and the other guys don't clap, and the headlines come out, and they're trying to... It is the
biggest display in partisan politics probably every year.
Yeah,
it is a bread and circus to some extent. Yeah. It's just a bread and circus for politicos.
Right. It's basically the Super Bowl for nerds.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, and
I will watch the Super Bowl this week, though, so
I think
that's
my
priority.
I used to be a nerd.
I am still a nerd.
No,
I just
clearly not.
I just am. My nerd priorities have shifted to some extent.
Did you hear him talk about Jordan Peterson before the show started? He's still in there.
Yeah.
No, I get what you're saying. Like it is always the same thing. You know, the guy comes out, he says, "Mr. Speaker," which was the job that I wanted as a kid. That was my dream job as a little kid. I wanted to work for Bob and Tom, done, and be the guy that says, "Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States." And this guy, Skeletor, who did it this year, I could do it so much better. Yeah.
No, but
anyways, my point is the guy comes out, he says that, the president goes up there, he promises a bunch of stuff he's never going to do, he promises a bunch of things that he wants to fix, he talks about how America's great, or in Barack Obama's case, how America sucks, and then they all clap, and then everybody debates over it, and we forget about it in a week, and none of that stuff that they promised ever happens.
No.
It would be great if the State of the Union had a reputation for having bombshells.
Right.
Like, not like faux pas, but actual bombshells, where every year the president comes out, and that's where he, like, it's like sweeps week. He saves his best for the State of the Union, and that's where he's like, all right, this is what I've done, or I'm about to do, I'm about to sign it. Heck, he could sign it right there.
Right.
Like, he pulls out, this is the bill, this is the law, signed. It's in, like, if they did something like that at every State of the Union.
That's what the Donald wanted him to do with the memo.
I would watch it.
They wanted him to walk up there and hold the memo out and read it aloud to the audience.
Who?
The Donald.
Oh,
that's what they said. Yeah, that's what they said.
Right,
that he
should do. My point is that stuff doesn't happen.
But you would have watched it if he did that.
Maybe, yeah. I might have. But, like, that's my point, is that the State of the Union is just this... It's just ceremony.
Right.
And to me, it's meaningless ceremony. It's not like we even need a State of the Union to know how the union's doing.
No, it's reflection on the progress of the year. You go through what you're going to, your roadmap for the next year. Like, it's pretty much the most public display of what you're going to do and what you're committing to doing as president.
It really, it's not even the next year. It's the next 6 days with the news cycle the way it is.
True.
No, I think it was important for Donald Trump because I think people wanted to see him unfiltered without the media filter on it. And the media couldn't have fallen apart worse after this. They were beside themselves because he didn't do anything outrageous or crazy, so now we're going to have to actually cover anything that he does that is political but not a sideshow. You know, they had to talk about his policies and cover him as though he were a normal president. And I thought it was a good speech. I thought that he was a definite shift from Barack Obama. Now, it's been 2 years since we've heard Barack Obama give a State of the Union. But if you remember Barack Obama's State of the Unions, it was kind of lecturing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Barack Obama would get up there and he'd talk about, "We made progress.
This was difficult, but this is what I'm going to do to fix it."
Right.
And this is what
we still have far to go, and we have not grown in these areas. You know, there's always a tone of scolding, and America doesn't like scolds. And Donald Trump, I don't know that for me, I was definitely not as jingoistic about it as Galt was. I'm not as much of a jingoistic person. I love my country. I don't love my government. I don't really give a crap. I could care less about the pledge. I stand for the national anthem because
pledge was written by a commie.
Listen, the Star Spangled Banner is named after me, so I got to honor it when they play my song. But no, he tried very hard to give a nod to the patriotic crowd and all that stuff, and that's his base.
That's,
and it's fine.
That's yeah, because he's got a that's one of his dramatis personae,
right?
Is to be the flag incarnate.
Yes,
more or less.
Yes, the flag incarnate is a good way to put it. And most libertarians, you'll see libertarians who outright hate any kind of nationalism. And nationalism and patriotism are two different things. Nationalism is a philosophical bent towards policies that keep the nation focused inward and favor isolationism, where patriotism is more pride around your nation. But the reason that a lot of libertarians don't like patriotism as a concept is because it leads people to bad consequences like the Iraq War. If you were alive during 2002, 2003, 2004, you remember how unpatriotic it was to speak out against the war, and we shouldn't use emotionally manipulative tactics like that when we're trying to debate policies that put our country and our soldiers in grave danger. And my own relationship with patriotism is that I am proud to be an American, and I'm glad that I am American, because the ideals of America and the foundation of this country are fundamentally libertarian. Individualism, limited government, free markets, the virtue of production,
the
peace.
Declaration of Independence is like is just
a libertarian document.
I mean, yeah,
yeah,
and it was just basically repurposed from George Mason, who basically repurposed it from John Locke. I mean, it's like all of these things that are fundamentally American values are more or less libertarian values. I mean,
right?
You know, I think that's why, to some extent, there has been a more of an allegiance amongst libertarians and conservatives throughout the 20th century than there has between libertarians and the left. And I know
right.
There's plenty out there that are shaking their hand at them at their radio right now for me saying that, because there's a history of the libertarians with the left. But like, let's be honest, like
we're a right leaning.
We are, and
yeah.
and we're just right leaning on the issues that tend to be.
You may come from the left,
yeah.
But once you're in the libertarian movement, I mean, when you start to economics, fundamentally, the economics that we believe in,
right,
are much more right than they are left.
But the reason that we're different from conservatives is because of, I think this is in the 20th century, it's happened more than anything, because of things like association with the nation state more than the individual.
Right.
Like libertarians fundamentally think of the individual as supreme. And once you get into a patriotism, I guess, bout, you start, the danger is that you hide underneath this, you use patriotism as a blanket to protect you from having to deal with hard issues.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to question the Iraq War, or you don't have to question something that's happening domestically. Like right now, the big one about patriotism is whether or not you stand or kneel for the anthem at football games.
Right.
Like, you know, you can ignore the point the person's trying to make who's protesting the national anthem because it's unpatriotic.
Mm-hmm.
Say, he just doesn't love his country, so I don't have to listen to a word he says.
Right.
And that's not fair, because
that's identity politics,
right? And you're using patriotism not as this positive thing to give you more of a sense of solidarity with where you came from,
mm-hmm.
and you're using it as a means to basically to shelter yourself from the realities of your world, and that's wrong. Don't close your eyes to the bad things that exist because you think that it makes you less patriotic. It doesn't. It makes you more patriotic if you want to fix those things that are happening in your, you know, in your society.
Yeah.
But it doesn't fit well with the idea, and frankly, the association with military as being patriotic. If you don't support some sort of military action, or you support reducing the military presence in some way, shape, or form, then you're not patriotic. And that is a very 20th century thing.
Yeah, I think Donald Trump's view of American exceptionalism is that we have the biggest military, the most wealth, and we have a white culture. And I don't think that he would expressly put it that way, but that's, in my mind, what a lot of Republicans, baby boomer Republicans, think about when they think about the America being exceptional. Whereas I would define American exceptionalism as a very libertarian way of thinking. We have freedom of speech. We have freedom. Privacy freedoms. You know, we have limited government. We have a capitalist system. These are all what made America great, not having the biggest military.
Right. When I and this is an honest truth. When I was younger, you know, you go, you talk, they talk, we talk about how schools pollute the young mind and they're just indoctrination camps, and that may be true, and it may not be. But when I was younger, in like, when I say younger, I'm like high school. We talked about, you know, the American dream, and people talk about the American dream this, the American dream that, and is the American dream still alive? And the way I was always brought, and this even goes back to like discussions on the founding of America, like what were the Puritans come here for and stuff. I had always had this impression that the American dream, so to speak, and even, like I said, Puritans and coming here to practice their religion, it was always they were running from governments.
Right.
The early 20th century, the Eastern Europeans, the Europeans in general coming here, Irish, maybe, I don't know, maybe not Irish to an extent, but more or less, they had these governments that were, you know, radically abusive, radically tyrannical, and they escaped that. They came to America because America was this shining city on a hill where the government would just leave you alone, and you could go and start your bakery on the corner, and you wouldn't have the jackboots coming in, taking half your bread, and then shooting you in the face.
Right.
Like, these are the kind of things that they were running from. And that was always like, that's why people want to come here, is because the government will leave them alone. And it turned recently, like, it seems like we've tried to rewrite that, and now the American dream was that you came here with the expectation of success, and you came here, the culture, you came here with this expectation that you were going to get into this culture that was specifically American, and it was, and frankly, it's never been that. It's always been an amalgamation of, you know, tons of different worldviews and cultures and stuff, and that's partly why America is great, is because, you know, you turn any random corner in Indianapolis, in any city, and you go to one state and go to another state, you've entered different worlds, fundamentally right. Different worlds, but they're all they're united in the sense that they're different. And if you come at all of this American exceptionalism as this like top down sort of like nostalgic view of the past, then it leads to problems because it's never been that way. You know, the good old days were never the good old days, and it doesn't give you any foundation upon which you can build the future, because it's built on a lie fundamentally.
The American dream was a gamble. The dream was that you could succeed, not that you would succeed. And I think that the left in the country has taken the American dream and said everybody is going to end up successful according to the way we define success, which is government programs.
Materialism. The American dream was that you could be part of the middle class.
Right.
Where that's not really what it was.
Yeah.
But that's how they interpret it. You could be part of the middle class. You could retire.
Right.
Or something. And it's like a very materialistic way of looking at things. Not to be surprised if we're talking about leftism. Mm-hmm. But
I don't know. I think I'm different than you guys.
In what way?
I think I'm very patriotic.
Sure.
I'm an Eagle Scout. If I was in a uniform, I would always salute the flag. I'd always stand for the anthem, things like that. The whole NFL thing always rubbed me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Even the libertarians, like they should always be able to do whatever they want, of course. But I never thought that was the right time to do it.
Is that great?
Or did they make any change ever? This whole thing? No, it's just been a spectacle.
No, I think that's not true. I would say that Colin Kaepernick raised the issue,
and it got talked about.
But then,
Facebook hashtags. Good job, guys. No.
Well, that's called society now. But then Donald Trump changed the issue to whether or not it was patriotic. And I would say
it isn't.
But I'd say it is.
That's not even the point. That's what I'm saying. That's not even the point of that.
Now
you've changed goalposts. Like he's trying to make a point, and instead of addressing his point, you say it's a red herring. Oh, well, that's all well and dandy, but you're disrespecting troops that are dying for your freedoms. It's like, that's not the issue.
Yeah, so he hijacked the actual conversation.
They hijacked the flag.
But
the flag doesn't have anything to do with the issues of
does it not?
No.
What does the flag represent then? It really only represents the good things? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Then it also represents the bad things.
It doesn't represent everything.
What is it? Then what the
point? So then every protest in the world can be protested by using the flag? That's the symbol of all protests?
No, in America.
It shouldn't be.
In Saudi Arabia, they burn it and protest.
If you're protesting police, then you should go protest the police department.
Either the American
flag.
It has
nothing to do with the flag.
Either the American flag specifically represents the United States government.
It does.
Then, or it represents the concept of Americanism. And if it represents the concept of Americanism, then it also represents the bad things that happen in our country. And that's what he was. That's why he targeted the flag itself. Not to mention because he knew that it would get people talking about it. And but if it represents just the government,
it's offensive.
Even if it does,
it
just,
got people talking about it because it's offensive.
Even if it does represent just the government, then it also represents the bad things the government does. So, like, you're basically trying to say the flag only represents the good things.
I have been fighting against the bad things the government does my whole life.
That's irrelevant.
And I still would not disrespect the American flag like that.
All right, so let me ask you this question, Galt.
Okay.
Do you believe that the flag represents, is it a political symbol?
Globally? Sure.
Okay. Or and domestically.
How about to you? To you specifically?
No.
Okay.
It's a symbol of my country. That foundation that you were just describing that you should be proud of.
Right.
That's what it stands for.
Included in that is the First Amendment and the citizens' duty to speak out against injustices that they see in the world. We may not agree with the injustices, but don't people have a right?
I do agree with the injustices.
Okay.
I just don't agree with the way they were protested.
Right. Do you think
that's where I'm different?
Do you think that we would have had?
He has so much time in front of reporters to voice an opinion, to have a coherent and discussion about an issue,
right?
Not to make a grandstand on his knees.
But don't you think that doing the grandstand, because he did do that before? But don't you think that during doing that stunt, let's call it a stunt,
that's still going on? I went to a Colts game,
right?
Just one of the last weeks, and they were still doing it,
right?
They'll still do it next year.
And
it'll never stop. What's the point?
Who cares?
Yeah.
What's the point?
So
why are we all upset?
How good
about
was
it?
That protest?
Right.
So why disrespect the flag? What's the point?
Right. But there nobody he specifically.
But
why
protest
stick up for,
anything at all? When was the last time a protest directly resulted in any kind of legal activity?
Of any kind. And that I agree. Like and that I think is what you're saying, like what's the point of protesting?
What's
like,
the point of protest at all?
All you're going to do is turn people like me off again.
Its point is to start people talking about things.
Right. Colin Kaepernick sat on the bench and then after talking to one of his teammates who was a soldier, started kneeling in protest because he didn't want to disrespect
soldiers.
I liked that story.
An actual veteran told him, yeah, you should probably kneel because it's a little bit better. And he did.
But the bottom line is Colin Kaepernick, specifically.
You know, and the step better than that is to not do it at all to the flag.
So I would say that, yes, the flag is a political symbol, but it is also, I don't know what the right word would be besides a political symbol, because it does represent the United States government. But I think to most Americans, it does represent something bigger. It represents heritage.
It's an avatar,
right.
More or less. I personally don't see it as being higher than the actions that it's supposed to represent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people look at this as if you protest the flag, well, you're protesting the very fundamental rights you have underneath that flag.
Right.
Like, you protest the American flag, then you're protesting your right to free speech. And all this.
You're,
like,
you're protesting that you don't want to follow the form of government that you have.
But that's not what they're doing. And I don't think, you have to be very dense to think that that's what they're trying to say. You have to emplace upon them a motivation like that.
The flag stands for that foundation that we've been discussing. Protesting that foundation, you're protesting the foundation of the libertarian principles that we agree with.
You're not, though, because that's not what
they're... You're saying the flag can stand for any individual reason that you want it to because it's an issue in American politics.
If we're not going to be...
You can get a flag to represent anything you want if enough people agree on it. That's the point of a symbol. You know, we have a Kekistani flag up there. I mean, that's, you know, enough internet trolls agreed that their nation was the Kekistani nation, and they created a Kekistani flag.
But, like, if you're going to sit there and try and say, you're trying to emplace a motivation upon them that is, again, different than what they're actually trying to say. You're not addressing the actual points that they're trying to make because you disagree with the vehicle, and that's fine. You can disagree with the vehicle, but you still are supposed to at least address what they're trying to say. And that's the whole thing, is everyone who disagrees with their point fundamentally has shifted the conversation. The people who do agree with their point say, look, I am fully aware that I have all of these rights under the United States government. I fully support the Bill of Rights and my fundamental rights as an individual, and I am proud that there are people out there who are willing to fight the enemies that want to tackle our system of government. They can literally come out and say that in words,
but
and
I
then
won't
their actions,
show it. Actions speak louder than words.
But their actions exist outside of football games. I'm not just talking about Colin Kaepernick. I'm talking about all of the individual millions of Americans that actually stand for. Like, are you going to sit there and tell me that all of the black Americans who support the guy taking a knee are bad Americans at the same time?
Man, I wish I was Jordan Peterson.
Because you just want to punch him.
You just like vastly generalized an entire argument, that we went through last week.
That is not what I'm asking you a question. If somebody who agrees with Colin Kaepernick taking a knee as a sign of protest because they agree with his fundamental point of, which he has said explicitly, is racial injustice in America. If you agree with his point, then you, by your logic, are at the same time fundamentally disrespecting the very form of government that has given them their rights as individuals in our society. And you're saying actions speak louder than words. But are you there? But that is implying, if you say that, that is implying that those individuals who agree with him are bad Americans.
No, it's not.
Yes, it does, because their actions as Americans are probably very good. They probably go to work. They contribute to society. They go to church. They do all of these things that good Americans do, but they agree with Colin Kaepernick on one protesting point, and therefore their actions suddenly speak, though that action suddenly speaks louder than all of the actions they do in their lives. People are more complicated than one protest. But that protest brought an issue out into the world for people to see. It wasn't just America. It was out into the world, and people talked about it. And that was his whole point. And you're going to try and say that that was fundamentally disrespectful, therefore let's ignore the point.
I didn't say that.
That's what you are implicitly saying.
That's what,
do you hear how he sounds?
That's my whole point. But
I did not say
Let me defend Galt here and say that is what Donald Trump is saying. I don't know that Galt is saying
I'm saying I agree with their issue.
I'm uncomfortable with,
yeah,
with
the
this
way
display,
they're doing it.
But Donald Trump has explicitly made it about,
because
you know, you're disrespecting
because
the flag. Yeah.
I come at this and I agree with their issue. Okay? So how do I show them when they're kneeling for the flag that I am on their side? When I'm patriotic and I've always will stand for the flag and I will always do that. How do I show my support? I can't.
Yes, you can.
It is a bad protest.
I think no.
But
I think if you're under your scenario, if that were the only way to protest, but you come on this podcast, you contribute to this network. Yeah.
I find my own other ways.
Exactly right.
But the regular person doesn't.
Was the only way
to the regular person? That's the only way to protest this issue now.
Was the only way to support civil rights in the 60s to go march on Washington? Was that the only way to show your support for civil rights?
But I think you two are kind of making each other's arguments now. So let's move on. I think that gave people a lot of food for thought, because fundamentally that's what nationalism is. And nationalism and patriotism, again, two different things, and I think you can be patriotic and not be nationalistic. I consider myself patriotic. I do love America. And I like the symbols of America because I like the good things about America. But I fundamentally take exception with the bad parts of America, and that's why I love the First Amendment. And I'm an aggressive free speech advocate. So even if I find a particular action like him kneeling during the flag to be, let's say, offensive existed, let's say I'm offended by it, I would not want to advocate for that right to be taken away.
Never. I'm
because
not saying that.
Not
at all.
not even just in the legal realm. I'm talking about team owners.
Yeah, like his job. No.
He shouldn't be punished. Mm. But I do understand that the free market Will, like, he was talked about to come here to Indianapolis, and he would have been a better quarterback than the one that the Colts had this year. And there was a revolt in the fan base.
Jacoby Brissett ain't too bad.
He wasn't bad.
Even in, already in high school, I was already a libertarian. Right. And I remember senior year when I had other friends that had already pulled over or were already there. And I remember multiple of them wouldn't even, like, pledge of allegiance or right. anything, wouldn't put their hand on it, wouldn't stand up for it. And I mean, that's fine. I've never said that they shouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not the issue.
I think every American built into the ideals that those symbols advocate for should have the right to abstain from them. You have the right to not abstain. And I think a lot of libertarians see patriotism and the flag and other symbols of patriotism as a gateway drug. It's a gateway drug to statism. And if you get on that slippery slope,
Trumpism.
if you say the pledge once, then the next thing you know, you're going to be wanting a war. And it's like, okay, well, you guys need to chill because that isn't necessarily the case. But I think the Barack Obama view of America was that America is great as France is great, as other nations are equal, whereas Donald Trump is much more of that unashamed pro-America. It was a much more optimistic speech than what we had over the past 8 years.
So good.
It was more optimistic than George W. Bush's speeches later in his presidency.
Yeah.
It didn't connect with me in the sense that I felt I know he probably believes that stuff, but I've lost trust in Donald Trump to say anything that he might mean or that I can count on, so that when he does give a speech like this, because I follow it so closely, I go, yeah, but he's going to tweet something tomorrow that's going to undermine everything
he
said. He didn't. And listen, the CBS numbers, I mean, let me get the numbers here, but
turning the page.
Yeah. Let's see. I don't know where it went. But yeah, it was really incredible, some of the numbers that came out of that speech. So
because he didn't do anything absurd during the speech. So if the media he knew that he just had to sit and wait because the media had nothing to attack him
Donald
with.
Trump.
All they did was make themselves even less credible.
Donald Trump gave a very normal speech that would have been average for it would have been panned if George W. Bush gave it because it was so long. It was the third longest. And it didn't get panned because Donald Trump is so absurd that when he meets the bare minimum of the presidency, we're all blown away. And listen to these numbers from CBS that happened during the speech. CBS, their YouGov poll and approval ratings. 97% of Republican speech watchers liked it. 72% of independents liked it. 43% of Democrats liked it. Those are really solid numbers.
Wow.
75% of America approved of the speech. 8 out of 10 Americans in the poll felt that the president was trying to unite the country with the speech, and 2/3 of Americans said it made them feel proud. Less than a quarter that watched it said it made them feel scared or angry. I'm reading this from the Daily Mail, which I know is not a real news source, but they do the best compilations of things, and this the article of this is American people turning against Trump hating celebrities. So you know I had to click on that. So they basically break down those numbers, and then they go into the celebrities on Twitter acting as if he had just committed the Kristallnacht and the beer hall pushed at the same time, and the night of the long knives was right after it. Sarah Silverman tweeted, "I was told darkness could not exist in the light, but here it is for everyone to not see." Jim Carrey tweeted an illustration of sharks across a map of America, then tweeted another weeping Abraham Lincoln, and the caption, "It's my party and I'll cry if I want to." Andy Lassner, this must be a column, producer of the insufferably smug The Ellen Show, which I've never found The Ellen Show to be smug, but okay. Good luck Saturday Night Live on trying to make this look any more fucking ridiculous than it already is. Jeffrey Wright raged, "Can't even watch this vile, deceitful fraud and his bizarre cult of self-interested sycophants."
That sounds exactly like what the Oscars will be like.
Exactly how I feel about the Oscars. Jessica Chastain urged people not to watch it all. Billy Eichner fumed, "The president is a lying, incompetent, racist, misogynist sack of shit." George Takei said, "I'm not watching some frothing orange gorilla read off a teleprompter." That's racist.
That would actually be really interesting to watch.
I would love to see an orange gorilla read off a teleprompter. Orange is not a race,
so it's not right. racist.
It's Oompa Loompa. an orange gorilla reading off teleprompter, I would click on that.
I know. So I don't know about you guys, but I really feel like we hit a turning point over the last month, and this kind of crystallized it all. We're in the middle of award season, and every award show is all about how much Trump sucks. They can't even congratulate themselves on anything that's going on. They have to talk about Trump. And let me be clear. I work in comedy. Spending your entire comedic performance beating up on Donald Trump is sad. That's lazy. The lowest form of comedy has been is beating up on Trump. And sorry, puns, you're out. Like, puns used to be considered the lowest form of comedy. Now it's Trump.
Unfairly.
Now it's Trump hate. No, they suck. They're stupid.
Bad puns. Puns.
Yeah, but, bad puns, but
so
you just got to be creative.
Yeah.
I feel like America has settled a little bit with Trump. I've noticed it in myself. I've noticed it in our audience. Since the tax cuts.
Yeah, when you're getting $1,000 bonuses in your paycheck, right. When you're getting more money back every
right.
week.
The economy's going well.
When your tax page is going to be one page long
I'm up 10% in my savings on Stash in 2 months.
You're not required to have health care.
I feel like... and I could be absolutely wrong on this, but I feel like the exhaustion with outrage culture
yes.
is reaching a tipping point.
Yes.
Where people are
hopefully
just so over every single thing being the worst thing that's ever happened.
Right.
And I think if that outrage culture goes, so does the absurdness of political discourse
right.
to a large extent. I mean, I could be 100% wrong, but I feel like that's starting to happen, and it'll probably be really bad, or not really bad. It'll probably happen a lot more or faster, or both. If whenever there's like an exodus from like Facebook and stuff,
yeah, which I think is starting to happen.
Yeah, so it's like as people. Because, you know...
We're not going to Google Plus, Colt. Fuck off.
Because, like, that's the thing.
I'm waiting.
Like, how do they get your attention? They try and piss you off. Like, one person says one dumb thing, and it hits, you know, whether it's campus reform or if it's the Huffington Post, somebody says something dumb, they write it as a headline, it gets you all mad, you argue in the comments for 10 minutes, and you realize you're wasting your time, and you go on about your life. And I think, like, that's...
sorry, but Logan says, puns about communism aren't funny unless everybody gets them.
That's a bad... That's not...
No, that was funny.
No.
That made me
laugh.
That's
an old joke.
Sorry to interrupt you, Creighton, but that's funny. I don't care who you are.
That's also
no,
a
good
joke.
I think that the tax cuts and then everybody's the Democrats' reaction going, it's going to kill people and everything's going to kill you and everything is hyperbolic.
Pushing Granny off a cliff. I'll never forget that.
Pushing Granny off a cliff. And now and then you get into award season and you see all these rich people who are not connecting to our lives in any way, shape, or form going, Abraham Lincoln's crying. When most of America, 75% of America watched that speech and liked it. When I am one of the fiercest critics of Donald Trump and somebody who doesn't like him and didn't vote for him and won't vote for him again, and I watched it and went, all right, not bad. I would give it a 75%. I'd give it a, you know, a nice solid C. I mean, it was a very good speech in the way that he used the stories, I think, better than... You always see, you know, look at little Bobby Brown up in the rafters, and he's got terminal butt cancer, and that's why we need to pass
no,
cancer
Trump,
reform.
Trump's delivery is just perfect.
Trump, you said with such a gloat.
There was tear-jerking.
He used the speeches. He told the story better than any president.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw Reagan's speeches, but everybody... that I heard said best since Reagan, and I would agree. in that when Barack Obama did it, it seemed like he was taking advantage of them. When George Bush did it, it was kind of like, eh. But when Trump did it, you went, damn. Especially the South Korean or the North Korean defector. When he raised up those crutches, I think that was such a powerful moment of human freedom.
Oh, and the two families with the daughters.
Yeah, and I think that North Korean moment was a moment when Donald Trump was saying to all of his critics in the chamber and watching, see, this is what an actual tyrant looks like, and I'm not a tyrant. But I thought he used the speeches, the stories very well, and he used the right stories that led into policy announcements, a lot of which I didn't like, but he used them effectively nonetheless. So, you know, he didn't drool. He didn't stand up there and drool like the Kennedy guy. But that's kind of what we all expected. So,
but it wouldn't be a great Donald Trump speech without a few little good jabs. instead of the whole thing being jabs like it normally is, he smoothed it in there like a real politician. It was beautiful.
Yeah, there wasn't anything in that speech that
was personal or anything.
Yeah, it was very well written.
It was very we we're in this together.
If you read the speech, I read the speech. It's very well written. Whoever wrote it did very well. But then once you get – so you see what Americans see with their eyes, and we've said this about Donald Trump on the program. You look at with your eyes with what's going on. Like you can trust what is happening with your own eyes instead of relying on other people. What's my gut – like rely on my gut. I'm relying on my gut instead of what does the left think? What is the right thing?
Don't you do that sometimes when you watch one of these and then you go on to the news and you're like, wow, they don't think anything like I thought
when I watched that. Let me give you 16 reactions. This is from, I don't know what site. I think this was from the Daily Signal, which is a conservative-leaning site. In 16 reactions, how the left responded to Trump's first State of the Union. The first one that everybody was talking about was Joy Reid, a host of MSNBC. And she writes on Twitter, church, family, police, military, the national anthem, Trump trying to call on all the tropes of the 1950s era nationalism. The goal of this speech appears to be force the normalization of Trump on the terms of a bygone era and his supporters are nostalgic for. So in her America, church, family, police, military, the national anthem, these are bad things. You couldn't be more out of touch with most of America. Stop living in the MSNBC bubble. Like, you're going to tell me that church or that family is a bad thing? Like, I can get down with the police brutality being a problem, and we have our over-militaristic, and the national anthem really doesn't mean much. But like, church and family are so fundamental to what most people, even the black community in this country, that vote 99% of the time with Democrats. Like, what are you talking about, Joy Reid? Melissa Michelson, professor of political science at Menlo College in California, tweeted, are they seriously chanting USA? I am embarrassed for my country. You mean the United States Congress? Like, what?
People chant USA at anything that involves, at hockey games. Anything. That's a dumb thing to be upset about.
A Princeton University professor of African American Studies, Keegan Yamahata, tweeted, the So Too is officially a Klan rally. University of Maryland College Park
What about all the African American congressmen women?
They were mad. They didn't stand up or clap or anything.
He's eating Sour Patch Kids, by the way, and smashing two Diet Dr. Peppers.
Don't tell me how to live my life.
Philip Cohn of University of Maryland College Park sociologist called it carnage porn.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. Nancy Pelosi tweeted, did you see her chewing her cud, by the way? Did you see the video? Did you at least see the video of her? Oh, my God. You guys missed Nancy Pelosi's face during that speech. No. It's worth watching. It's
chewing what?
Her cud, like a cow. You know what cows chew? Like, she's literally just grass. Like playing with her dentures in her mouth.
That's weird.
Nancy tweets, the So Too performance last night was just that, a performance completely devoid of serious policy ideas that lead to real bipartisan efforts.
But I mean, talked about compromising his whole thing with the wall and letting millions of people become citizens so that he could get compromise and get his wall and work with them, and they just sat there.
He said, I want to give you paid leave. You know what paid family leave is? That is a new entitlement program, so when you have a child, you get to stay home and the government will pay you for it. Ah! Chucky, baby. Chuck, we heard from Nancy, now we got to hear from Chuck. After a long and divisive year, many Americans were yearning for the president to present a unifying vision for the country. Unfortunately, his so-to address stoked the fires of division instead of bringing us closer together. I got to be honest, like, he was trying to be bipartisan and strike a bipartisan tone. I don't believe him. I wouldn't believe him if I were Chuck Schumer either, but at least he was trying.
There was nothing he could have said to make Chuck Schumer not say that exact same thing.
That's the point.
There's nothing that he could have said in his speech that would have made him happy.
Right. He is literally...
He's just hating to hate. Haters going to hate.
Nancy says that he's putting on a performance. Like, they're all putting on performances.
Exactly.
These tweets are performances. Yeah. They are demonstrating that they're still with their base. Like, they have to say this stuff, or else their base is going to think that they've gone soft.
Right.
Like, they're not... They may actually believe it, maybe, but I think their motivation is more to make sure that the voters know that they're still anti-Trump, even though Trump might have had a good night.
Yeah.
Like, it's all a performance.
And that's a great point. Pocahontas tweeted, America isn't prouder when Donald Trump embraces bigotry, hatred, and fear and calls that patriotism. Okay. Sarah Silverman...
Is that his Pocahontas voice?
That's my Pocahontas
voice.
That
was his Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah. I can do better. I'll do better next time. Sarah Silverman says, there's an evil genius in rebranding family reunification to the dehumanizing, infestation-sounding chain migration. What? It's always been called chain migration. That is, in legal circles, what it's called. Rebranding it as family reunification is the rebranding, Sarah.
Why do they hate America?
I don't know that they hate America. They hate Donald Trump.
They hate all the symbols for America, at least. Right? They're disgusted that we would chant USA. What? Why?
Here's
did they not have control for the last 8 years to implement the changes that they wanted to see in the country?
Right. And
in 1 year, they hate hearing us chant America?
Well, generalization.
They as in the people on that list that
okay.
you just read.
Yeah. No,
like, why do they hate America so much?
I don't know. Well, I think they are virtue signaling to the people that they want to be accepted by. I don't think that they hate America. They love their version of America, which is frankly a form of globalism. I mean, as outlined by Barack Obama. I'm having brain farts like crazy. I'm
Hussein.
Tired of
that. Hussein's his middle name.
Hussein. Yeah. But they are so out of touch with how most Americans perceived that. And the award shows are massively down because they're so out of touch. And the media is exactly in the same place because they're all trying to be friends with each other. And every celebrity is trying to become a political pundit. Jay-Z's on Van Jones. And every media, every nerd who's ever written for any publication or is on TV is trying to go to the Academy Awards and have famous friends.
There is no truth in media anymore.
Well,
none.
There's different...
And there's so much smaller media that you don't know what's true either. On
right.
both scales, though.
Right.
At the top, you can't trust them at all. And at the bottom, there's so many different views you don't know.
I don't know that I don't look at it that way. Like, when I read the New York Times, I feel that I'm getting the truth. But I don't feel like I'm getting the truth when I watch Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
The first thing I think when I read a New York Times article is this even true? And I look up another source.
No, like I've said,
I don't think that they're giving out inaccurate facts. I think
they're not giving you the whole story because they don't know
right.
the whole story.
Well, that and plus,
yes, they do.
It is impossible to remove bias from any kind of description
right.
of current events or history or anything. Like, it's literally impossible. What we hope is that reporters make a good attempt to make it unbiased. But nowadays, it's actually in vogue to be as biased as possible.
You're right. Like, let me give you an example. There's this website called Liberty Hangout. okay, this website and Facebook page is the libertarian version of Gateway Pundit, okay? And they have an article claiming that the National Libertarian Party disinvited Ron Paul to their convention, when in reality, the guy who was heading the convention in a private chat message just basically said, nah, I'm not really, he's not on my radar, I'm not thinking about it. And they basically created a headline that made it look like, you know, Judge Napolitano and Ron Paul rejected from the Libertarian Party convention. The guy was responding to a private Facebook message. He wasn't all that enthused. He was talking to somebody that basically writes for a website where they make stuff up and do this to people. It wasn't from the stage. It wasn't from Nick Sarwark. It wasn't from any kind of official position. And Ron Paul, they don't have the $30,000 that Ron Paul would have charged him in the first place. So,
and it that's fake news,
right?
That continues that same narrative that libertarians are all infighting.
Exactly,
and it
right.
keeps pushing that same thing forward.
And it's being pushed by the Mises Caucus, who obviously loves Ron Paul and Lou Rockwell, and they have a candidate that is running against Nick Sarwark, and they're trying to make their candidate look like the purest white knight coming in to save the party. And that's an example of somebody who doesn't have any journalistic training, and if they did, they wouldn't have any journalistic integrity. It's like Michael Wolff claiming that Donald Trump and Nikki Haley had an affair. Doesn't matter how many times she says that's not true, and it's an incredibly misogynistic for you to even keep pushing the idea that I got my position because I slept my way to the top. And oh, where are all the feminists out there defending Nikki Haley from this guy? Kudos to Mika Brzezinski for kicking the guy off the show when he would refuse to backtrack that or at least defend his answer. I mean, it's just a spurious allegation, and it's really disgusting. But you can say whatever you want, but there is some sort of editorial standard. And does the New York Times always get it right? No. Do they always report the right things? No. But by and large, I read the New York Times every day, and I find a lot of stuff where I go, this is really good journalism. This is the stuff we need to be reading about. They've made an extra push to take on drone warfare. That's the kind of stuff we want.
We can't restrict what we call journalism to what is more or less editorialism.
Right.
Like, you know, if you're talking about, oh, the president is going to push for some new policy and you're just reporting that they pushed for the, there's going to push for the new, I mean, that's fine. Like, that's just, you're basically right. doing C-SPAN's work for them. But, like, we tend to think of that's where journalism stops.
Mm-hmm.
And we exclude things like investigative journalism, just world affairs, like
right.
talking about things that happen in other countries. Like, these are all things that are also talked about, but we don't, when we say that journalism's biased, we're mostly talking about the purely editorial aspect of
yeah.
it, which, of course, that's the whole point.
Right. Like CNN, there is no doubt in my mind that CNN is incredibly biased against Donald Trump. They may not be left biased, they are, but they may not be left biased, but they are definitely anti-Trump. And that was probably the first 2 hours on CNN in 2 years where there wasn't wall-to-wall Russia coverage. I mean, it is outrageous how much time they spend on the Russia coverage because it's getting them ratings. If you're watching TV news, you're having your intelligence insulted, plain
mm-hmm.
and simple. If you're watching any form of television news, local TV news is nothing but the blotter report from the police department and weather reports and AP sports reports.
There was one exception. Did you hear what happened with him?
No.
Yeah, he's back.
Who?
Ben Swan.
Ben Swan's back. Yep.
He's back.
He got $2.3 million from Dash Coin.
Yeah. So
if anybody knows,
he could quit at that local cable channel and make some real investigative news.
Someone please get me in touch with Dogecoin or Ripple or something. I need to get in on this crypto stuff. But yeah.
It tanked today.
What did Ripple?
Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That's fine.
It's all right. It'll all be good. So let's kind of go through what
Robinhood launches next week.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I love
Robinhood.
You don't
have to go through Coinbase anymore.
Listen, guys.
It's down 1,300.
It's gonna. I hope it keeps going down and going down.
Here's what I was
down, and so is like.
I can buy more of it.
I'm going. Here's what I'm going to ask of you. If you want to get your savings right, if you want to get your investing right, please, I'm going to put in the show notes Stash, Digit, and Robinhood affiliate links. and you sign up for these services. If you're going to sign up for Robinhood, if you're going to sign up for Stash, you're going to sign up for Digit, I recommend all three. Please use my link so I can get free money. It costs you nothing. It gives me money. It's a great way to support me. I love Digit. I'm saving up money to go to LibertyCon for Students for Liberty, and I'm using Digit to do that because it's just a basic savings account. I would greatly appreciate the help that costs you nothing. You'll start saving money, and I love Stash. Like I've saved like $300 with these two apps alone. So anyways, let's go ahead, Galt. Let's get into the actual meat of the speech. The Daily Signal, out of all the sites, had the best breakdown of kind of everything. It's like 16 pages here. We're not going to read everything, but it's a really good guide as to what was talked about. And they had the policy people at the Heritage Foundation kind of break things down for us. So we're going to go through some of the highlights here and give you an idea of what was in the speech in case you're like Creighton and didn't listen to it.
What?
Yeah. Excuse me. First up, so you can break it down into basic sections: economy, law, immigration, defense and foreign policy, energy and infrastructure, healthcare, and education. Tax reform is delivering results was basically what he started with. And talking about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was providing tremendous relief for people. 260 businesses across all industries announced raises, bonuses, and new investments benefiting 3 million Americans. Next month, American workers will get a bigger paycheck thanks to tax reform.
Woo!
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can all be for that.
Yes, we can.
So
it's we know we wouldn't have had that with anybody else.
It's, well, I don't know about that. It's expected to result in hundreds of thousands of new jobs and wage increases. These expire in 2026, these individual and business tax cuts. So, but they're not going to.
Asterisk, they expire.
It's a great time to be alive.
They're not going to expire.
It's like the Patriot Act is sunset. Yeah. Okay, we'll be 85.
And Patriot Act did sunset. And then it was just replaced by something else.
Right. That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
They're going to extend them, or they're going to just get enough people in the Senate to override that Senate
That's
rule.
That's the one thing I'm liking about how Trump does this stuff, though. He is following the Constitution. He's not just passing everything with executive orders like Obama did. Mm-hmm. Obama did most of his immigration reform through executive orders. Trump says, I'm going to Congress. This is how it's supposed to be done. This is who I'm going to. And he defers to Congress for all these things.
It helps when you have a Republican House and a Republican Senate. We'll see how that works out in about 9 months.
Obama also went to Congress in his first year in office.
Yeah, for it was very good for a year. So most Americans will receive a tax cut. He talked about the Joneses. They have three kids and a mortgage. As a sales rep and part-time nurse, they currently earn $75,000 a year. Under the new bill, they will keep an extra $2,000. Of their money.
I don't remember where I was watching this. I think it was Reason, but it might have been a different news outlet. They went to all of these various groups of various economic strata and asked, they had an accountant basically go over all of their stuff and see what they would get under the new tax reform. And everybody, every one of them had to pay less.
Yeah.
All of like, even the like the 100K per married couple, you know, they make like 200K, and then the one that made like millions, like all of them. The poor guy, the middle class, the upper middle class, all of them, they all had to pay less. And a lot of them were like, wow, I was under the impression that I was going to have to pay more here. Or, and all this stuff. You know, I'm relatively wealthy.
Because they listen to the media.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's like every single one of them.
And I think that's why this was a big win for Trump and the best night of his presidency, because it was him unfiltered. People were hearing him. He did he had great showmanship.
Well, he's always unfiltered.
And he was relishing being clapped by the people that he wants to so desperately like him. I mean, he wants those people to love him so badly.
It's great seeing him unfiltered, because just like that Peterson video and how they kept cutting it to make it fit their narrative, and how they'd use her summaries of what he answered to make it the summary videos look like that.
Right.
They can't do that to his speech when you listen to the whole thing.
Yeah.
But you catch that stuff later and people have different opinions of it later. That should be some research that somebody does. Initial reactions, and then like weekly or like a day or two later reactions of people just reading it from the news. And I bet that's completely different, like on a whole scale.
Thank you for extending. I was yawning, Galt. Good job. I waved at him. I was like, go, I'm yawning. I'm just tired this week. I didn't have much of a weekend. So, all right. Tom Wong is a teacher, earns $50,000. About 10% of that goes to taxes. Under the new bill, he will expect $1,100 in savings. More than 80% of Americans receive a tax cut. Fernandez family owns a blinds and shades business, will get a tax cut.
Corporate tax rate.
Their hard work paid off and their company earned $250,000. Now they can invest an extra $13,000 in their business.
From 35% to 21%.
Right.
Corporate tax rate. That is unbelievable.
Yeah, that's where everybody
that's
all,
huge.
On the left, that's if you look at the narrative of the tax reform immediately during and after its passage, it was that the rich were going to be the tax cuts and all of everybody else is going to have to pay more in taxes. And then everybody's like, actually, you're misinterpreting the data. That's wrong. And they and a lot of media outlets changed their tune on that. And they said it was some bad, like, it wasn't necessarily factually incorrect, but it was one specific circumstance that was not indicative of everybody's experience under the new tax reform.
Right.
So they stopped saying that. And then they said, well, now the story was, and this was more because of House and Senate Democrats than the media per se, but the media definitely ran with it, was that the corporate tax cut does not sunset, whereas the individual tax cut does sunset. And that really tells you where the Republicans' priorities are.
Mm-hmm.
They're with the corporations. They're making their tax cut permanent, and your tax cut ends. It's like, well, and actually, the reason that that happened was because there's a rule in the Senate that you need 60 votes to make any kind of individual tax cut be permanent. So what they did was they didn't get enough Democrats to support the tax cuts that would have made those individual tax cuts permanent, and only the corporate tax cut had the requisite votes, or the Senate rule was not built
around
that.
Because it had Democrat support.
Well, I don't know if the rule applied to corporate tax cuts like the individual tax cut, so that might have been the difference. But regardless, the reason that it wasn't permanent was not because of some sort of right-wing conspiracy to bring individuals under the thumb of corporations more. It was actually because the Democrats were just so opposed to any kind of tax reform that they didn't support it at the level that was necessary to bypass this Senate rule, which is just a Senate rule that was passed parliamentary procedure at some point in the past, and it's still on the books. It's just the Senate rule. So it was a Senate rule that made this happen. That means that the only reason was because not enough Democrats supported it. So,
right.
But that's still the narrative. And
right.
And but it's really telling, though. I mean, it's and frankly, it's
really easy to create absurd. Those false narratives.
Yeah.
But the corporate tax rate, to its credit, is a double tax.
Right.
Right. You know, like we all talk about, you know, how everything. Well, I mean, technically everything's an income tax. Eventually you get your income taxed.
Yeah.
But the corporate tax rate is one where you raise corporate taxes. You basically just reduce the amount that they produce because you give them more cost of doing business, and you have less stuff, and so their stuff costs more. So they
right.
they pass the cost onto their workers and onto consumers more than they do anything else. So yeah, reduce the corporate tax. You're actually going to help out consumers, but
and workers. And that is the biggest highlight of Trump's amazing speech. Workers. American workers.
Is it annoying how much he likes Trump?
I know.
I don't. Whoa, whoa, where did that come from?
You're just very happy about Trump. And like,
he didn't talk about the Fed. He didn't reduce spending.
I know.
Like, it's not perfect. I don't like the wall.
Well, he didn't say that he was a messiah. He said that you're treating him like he's the awesome.
I'm just not, I just don't get all the hate.
Here's the thing. All right. Here's where I agree with you, because I'm listening to a bunch of libertarian podcasts today. I'm trying to see how did the libertarian podcaster universe respond to President Trump's State of the Union. And A, none of them do it very well, because none of them follow politics like we follow politics. Jason Stapleton may be the closest in terms of following politics because he does a daily show.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them don't understand politics fundamentally because they're mostly professors or people who just kind of work other jobs, you know, and having been involved in media and politics for 15 years, I understand how politics works. I follow the news daily, the ups and downs of it for 20 years. And so you kind of have a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guys just kind of fall back on typical anti-government cliches. And you just go, this is just really boring and really disappointing. And here's the thing about the State of the Union. Yeah, it is monarchical BS, and it is kind of a waste of time, and it is silly. But This is when people who are normies dip their toe in the water. They think, oh, it's like the church and Easter crowd for for Sunday. You know, like the Christians that go on Christmas Eve and Easter. This is when normies who are kind of involved in politics and reading the news, and they go, I should probably spend 5 minutes of my day reading the news. This is when they watch the State of the Union, and then they go, you know what, I wonder what libertarians think of this. And then they tune in and they get, well, he shouldn't have done a speech because there should be no government.
I don't know if any normies are saying that.
My point is
I wonder if any libertarians think about this.
Right. But
they're probably like, oh, that was nice.
Yeah.
This is us as on.
Gary Johnson doesn't even know what a State of the Union is.
Right. So you forgot me there. But it is one of those things where, like, they kind of – it's an opportunity for you to apply libertarian principles or at least explain politics to people, and you're kind of failing. And it's a real missed opportunity. And it – like the people who I just hate the State of the Union. I hate that this is ridiculous. I hate Donald Trump. I guess I kind of like this tax cut thing though. And you listen to a lot of these libertarian podcasts that are like, I know I'm supposed to hate Donald Trump, and I know I'm supposed to not like Republicans or Democrats, but I kind of like that 21 million people don't have to hire an attorney next year to fill out their taxes. You know, they're like, there's like this begrudging acknowledgement that there are some things that are going on that are good, and I don't get it. Like, because they're...
It's been 1 year.
A Democrat...
That's why I'm kind of hopeful about it. It's been 1 year. This is the most progress I've ever seen in 1 year out of Washington.
Like, there, you can like some things about Donald Trump's policies. There are things about Barack Obama's that I think I complimented Barack Obama once on the show.
And the things we don't like about him right now.
Okay. Right.
I hear you. But, like...
We'll get to some...
Spending and, yeah. and the wall and stuff. It's like... Or the Federal Reserve.
North Korea. Stuff like that. There, later
he has,
in the speech,
he,
may, we
will
get
he
to
has
it.
At least 3 more years to deal with some of those issues.
Right.
In 2 years, if he brings up the Fed, are you going to listen to that speech?
Maybe, but I don't think he will.
No. I mean, honestly, just seeing Nancy Pelosi and Democrats cry last night was kind of a treat.
Well, you can't take down the secret powers of the Fed without first taking down the secret powers of the intelligence community. And that is exactly what he's doing right now.
We'll get to the memo at the end of this. But, yeah, so he's going to simplify the tax code so less people have to hire accountants. No individual tax, a mandate tax. So basically the Obamacare...
The individual mandate's gone.
Exactly right. You aren't forced to buy. He basically called it a tax. He used the John Roberts test and basically said, no, John Roberts said it wasn't a tax, right? No,
they said it was a tax.
It was a tax.
Obama
okay.
and company and the government, the attorney, whoever was arguing on behalf of the government and the Supreme Court, they were saying that it was a fee, but they were allowed to make it a fee.
Right.
And John Roberts said, well, no, it's a tax, and that's how we're going to save it.
Right.
Like, they basically completely rewrote the law just so that it wouldn't go away.
Right. Government reorganization, he highlighted that he's done a lot of things to, quote-unquote, restore the bonds of trust between our citizens and their government. Good luck. You're, like, the last person that is qualified to do that. No, second to last. The last was Hillary. So Heritage responded to the president's executive order to reorganize the federal government by producing 2 comprehensive reports that would be probably worth your time. Things like cross-cutting government reforms, making federal compensation more competitive with private sector and reducing red tape, and more than 100 individual proposals to cut waste, duplication, inefficiencies, and unnecessary federal functions.
Mm-hmm. I do not want federal compensation to be more competitive with private.
It just leads to monopolies. And I apologize, I'm having such a hard time talking tonight.
Love that that's been a focus of Trump's administration, though. Cutting back those roadblocks for businesses, big and small, so that they can operate more efficiently, save money, pass that on to consumers and employees.
I will give him
it's
credit.
It's really,
for the
really
regulations.
Good. And it's real action too. It's like that he sent people out to these businesses to meet with them. You saw even I think it was yesterday when he was on the news talking with some of them. But he's been doing this for a while with lots of businesses.
Right.
He's like, tell me, list the things out that are in your way with the government. Like, tell me the things. And then he comes back to him with a plan. And, like, these are the things that we can probably help with.
Yeah.
And there's real action there. And it's just there's lots of businesses I've been reading about where they've never seen action from an administration like this before, Where usually they'll talk to him or tell him things, but they'll never take the follow up and actually do it.
With Barack Obama, there was always an uncertainty of what the government might do because he might place a regulation on you.
Yeah, and that was his way to address all of these societal ills.
Yeah, right. Punish it.
Make another bureaucrat give another bureaucrat some power. And frankly, I will say if there's one thing I can say that I have 100% all of this no shame support for Trump on, it's the federal regulation thing.
Yeah.
Like, he has done a lot to get rid of to bring down the register, and that's really good because outside of the fact that a lot of times regulations are in and of themselves cronyist, which a lot of people on the left don't like to admit, but regulations are not written by politicians; they're written by
lawyers,
a lot of times by the actual lobbyists that are lobbying for them,
for big businesses to keep small competitors out of the marketplace,
and that's a big reason for a lot of regulations. So if you ignore that aspect of it and say, well, just look at just the burden of following them, you know, just dumb stuff that, you know, maybe one thing went wrong one time 30 years ago, they passed a regulation to prevent that from ever happening again, and it never actually would have happened again regardless, and now, but you still have all this red tape you have to follow that's expensive. So, I mean, yeah, it makes business harder to do. You have to hire a lawyer just so you know if you've broken a law or not.
Right.
And it gets rid of, frankly, anti-competitive, anti-free market aspects of the regulations, the motivation for them.
Yeah,
again, the cronyist aspect.
It's absolutely a step in the right direction. This next part is, there's two different philosophies. There's the Barack Obama philosophy, the Democratic philosophy of the government is basically good and it's filled with hardworking people and it's filled with a lot of things that are taken care of. Barack Obama wanted to protect bureaucracy from the forces, the evil forces of the Republicans. Donald Trump, I think more than any one of those 16 candidates that would have gotten elected, could care less about bureaucrats and is trying to actively root them out. He's like a termite. He's eating it from the inside. And so we can applaud that. And
something that's worth noting, and this is something that I think Ludwig von Mises wrote about, is that bureaucracy is self-perpetuating.
Right.
There's not, you don't understand bureaucracy. I think it was Thomas Sowell who said something, I'm paraphrasing and I'm probably butchering it, but you don't understand bureaucrats until you understand the only thing bureaucrats care about is process and not results.
Right.
And that's the whole thing. It's like bureaucrats are, if they fix the problem they're supposed to fix, they're not needed.
Yeah.
And so you can realize the incentive is backwards there. Like,
right.
Their existence relies on the problem. And their existence is more profound if there are more problems.
Mm-hmm.
So a bureaucrat lobbying for more regulations is like, oh, well, they're there. They see the problems. They're probably inventing problems.
Yeah.
So a bureaucrat is a self-perpetuating machine.
And I wouldn't qualify Barack Obama as a good leader. And he was really, in a lot of ways, lead bureaucrat for those 8 years. I wouldn't qualify Donald Trump as a good leader either. Hmm. But at least he's hostile to bureaucrats. And he's doing everything he can to remove them. He said to...
Was Bush a good leader?
Yes.
Okay.
I think he was.
At the beginning, he was.
Yeah,
sure.
I think during the...
Right after 9/11, he was probably the most presidential president we've ever had.
Yeah, I think that was the... I think that was the period when he was a good leader. I think his judgment on Iraq was...
Yeah, his Iraq war
abysmal.
Was when he went...
Yeah. He not only made the wrong decision in going to Iraq, but he also operated the war at that period in a very poor manner. And I think if you look at the ISIS result, you see Donald Trump has put the right people in place to, you know, if you're, listen, as a non-interventionist, we shouldn't be there. But if we're going to have the destruction of ISIS, Jimmy Mad Dog Mattis has been better than David Petraeus was, or McChrystal before
sure.
him. So,
sure. Yeah.
So, in that respect, Trump has been a good judge of, by all accounts, Mattis is very well liked and one of the most popular people to ever serve at the DOD and in the military, and isn't one of these guys who is, I get the sense in reading about Mattis that he is one of those people who doesn't want to go to war. Like, he's actively trying to avoid wars, you know, and you
it
did
seems,
not.
It seems like, which is ironic given that his
His nickname is Mad Dog.
Well, he's also called the Warrior Monk, and he's very well educated. Madis is a fascinating character to read up on, and I think if we stay out of wars, it's largely because of Jimmy Madis. I don't think you had that in Tommy Franks and some of the other people that we had during the Bush administration. I think you had people that were really pushing him to go to war in Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney, in Donald Rumsfeld, and these were the same people who fucked up Vietnam. You know, so these people shouldn't have been advising George W. Bush, and that in and of itself is a failure of leadership. But in the days after 9/11, I think it's hard not to think that he was a good leader during that period. If you were cognizant, I mean, I was 18 and I was weeping at every George Bush speech in that period. You know,
like, yeah,
because I was just a mess. But
you can never prepare for those things.
You can't. No, I mean, there's no school to teach you how to be president.
Could happen
on 9/11.
Tomorrow,
right? God forbid. So reforming the federal workforce, Congress should respond to the president's call, they write, to, quote-unquote, empower every cabinet secretary with the authority to reward good workers and to remove federal employees who undermine the public trust or fail the American people. Rachel Gresler of the Heritage Foundation writes, removing a federal employee should not be tantamount to a criminal prosecution and take well over a year to complete. It should be less burdensome to remove federal employees, and the federal government should become more competitive and result in $300 billion in taxpayer savings over a decade. I don't believe that you can run a government like business. Business and government are two completely different things.
They operate on completely different signals.
Yep, but
they're fundamentally not trying to do the same things.
Right, but you should be able to remove people.
It should be easier to fire and hire, for
right.
sure.
Especially FBI.
Yeah. When we talk about the memo, never mind. We'll wait. I'll wait through the memo.
All right. So, sizing down the administrative state. On Tuesday, Trump said that his administration has eliminated more regulations during its 4 years in office than any prior administration in history. Now, Trump said that, so let's not take that to the bank. Yep. I did not verify
that. Before you go any further, so far, does this not sound like the most libertarian president in history? So far.
In history?
No. I don't know about it. In history. I'm ignorant
since
of what
World
James
II,
K. Polk
know.
Did, but
since World War II,
at least
know,
over the last
maybe.
50 years, yeah, I'd say.
Out of Bush and Obama.
Definitely.
Maybe probably.
But we're still only first.
You didn't want to give that to me last week, that's why I'm asking.
Well, we're about to get to the little non-libertarian things.
Oh, yeah,
like,
I know. That's why I stopped you.
You also weren't just talking about achievements, you were talking about stated goals as well.
Right. Longstanding criticism of the administrative state is that it imposes unduly burdensome costs in the American economy through the issuance of blizzard of unnecessary rules that stifle investment and reduce employment. In 2015 alone, the Obama administration imposed more than $22 billion in annual cost on the nation. During the presidential campaign in the first year of his administration, Trump made it clear that they need to address that problem. He's tried to carry out this reform in two ways. First, he appointed Mick Mulvaney to head the Office of Management and Budget.
Which that is a good yeah. Mick Mulvaney. Even
great
before this, he was a Liberty, like a Liberty Caucus
right.
guy. That guy is good.
Yeah,
he's not great on the Fed, but overall, that dude is really good. So that in and of it, and frankly, if there's anything that's as far as what he's done, that's probably the most longstanding. That's gonna it's appointments.
Yeah.
Other than Jeff Sessions, his appointments have been really good.
Yep, I agree. He also appointed Naomi Rao to head the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Together, they see their mission as implementing the president's goal of eliminating unnecessary regulations. Second, Trump issued a series of executive orders directed at senior agency officials to aggressively review the effects of the excessive federal agency regulations have had on economic growth and to eliminate unnecessary rules to ensure that agencies do not act in ultra-vires manner. That must be a typo. And to respect the values of federalism and to always measure and be guided by the costs and benefits of any rule an agency considers. Third, an additional step in his regulatory reform, Trump signed 15 congressional joint resolutions passed under the Congressional Review Act of 1996. Those joint resolutions nullified agency rules promulgated during the last year of Obama's administration, or in one case in 2017 by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Did he get rid of that completely or just...
No, he basically made it a zombie organization. Okay. He put Mulvaney in charge of it, okay. And Mulvaney's, you know,
Yeah, because that's what they said. Oh, hey, how can we deal with the financial crisis back in 2008? Obama took over. Well, how can we do? Well, we'll make a new department that is in charge of making sure that
right.
You know, like that's nope. always your solution. Is just we just need another department. We need another. We need right. some more bureaucrats.
So
we're one bureaucrat away from utopia.
So now we start to get into the stuff that we're not crazy about. He's been inconsistent on trade. First year of the Trump administration, the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, writes, has seen more towards movement toward economic freedom than most proponents of limited government pro-growth policies had hoped for. However, the trade policy and rhetoric of the past year runs counter to these job-creating trends.
Protectionism.
Yeah. So they say, for instance, suppose a foreign company builds an oil processing facility on a barge in Houston. If the facility and its jobs is towed away to another country, the value of the facility counts as an export, and shipping the barge away tilts the balance of trade towards a surplus. If instead the facility is permanently moored in Houston, it adds to our foreign debt. For most people, trade surplus sounds better than foreign debt. In both cases, our hypothetical example, a foreign company paid for something made by Americans, but in the worst-sounding case, the permanent operating jobs stay in the U.S. So
trade deficits are meaningless.
Right.
And I say that knowing that every economist is going to be like, blah, 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 blah. But like, the balance of trade is always technically equal,
mm-hmm.
Unless you print money, and then there is technically a surplus. But that goes away when the money gets out and the money the value of the dollar
changes. We always print money.
But like I know, but my point is that to put on my economist hat is that you know there's always going to be a net. This is something you can very easily see in a book like Economics in One Lesson, which I don't know if I've ever mentioned that one before.
We all have a million times.
But but that one basically the balance of trade. Is always going to be more or less equal, because unless again there's more money printing. Because you know, if you buy Chinese goods, then what does the Chinese guy have?
Right.
Dollars. What are they going to buy with dollars? They're going to buy American goods. I mean, that's a simplification, but you can imagine that all that happens is the hands in between you buying the Chinese good. There's a bunch of hands. There's a bunch more steps. There's a bunch more people it has to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it all comes down to. Your money doesn't actually represent anything but past production. So when you buy stuff from another country, you're trading them goods that you've produced, and they're trading you goods that you've produced.
Right.
And you know, if you think about it that way, there is no trade deficit, more or less. You're just trading goods.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to remember that money represents past production. Again, printing money. If the Fed just printed $1 million and bought some Chinese good. They're actually going to work and out better at the end because by the time the Chinese start spending all that money, it's going to actually become devalued, and they're going to be able to get less with that than we were able to get from them.
Right.
But after they've done that and the value of the dollar evens out, it comes back to this parity thing. So trade deficits, which Trump likes to talk about and economists in general I think like to talk about, and maybe I'm radical for saying that the trade deficit doesn't matter because technically it does in a political sense. But it ultimately, economically speaking, doesn't matter.
Right.
And, you know, if you're a free trade guy, then you have to – those mercantilism back during pre-Adam Smith days was one of their big things was about the balance of – the net balance of payments. They wanted more gold in their country than out of it.
Right.
Because they fundamentally didn't understand what trade was. And that's really what somebody talked about trade deficit is doing. They don't really know. What trade is.
Why are you laughing, Galt?
I just like listening to Crane talk autism, sometimes.
The autism flowing out of his mouth.
It just kept going.
Yeah. It's
it
great,
was like
though.
Three stories in a row.
I know. It was like, can he not move to New York? This is great.
This is they were all relevant. They were
yeah,
all related.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. He's going to seek a UK-US trade agreement.
Ooh, good.
Trump briefly mentioned, which is ironic that it was briefly, about appointing excellent originalist judges.
Oh yeah,
that he's remaking the judiciary. To date, the Senate has confirmed 13 courts of appeals judges, more than any U.S. president in history.
On judges, did you see today that there was this was on Reason?
So you had to cut him off for that.
Yeah, because there did he appointed Alito, right?
No, that was Bush.
Okay, no, are you
no,
sure?
it was
yeah.
Rogers and Alito.
Okay,
yeah.
So Gorsuch. He
There's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now that they're taking arguments, and I'm going to butcher the facts of this case, but more or less comes down to a woman or a guy, somebody rented a car, and then they let their friend drive the car without actually having them on the rental agreement. And that guy got pulled over, and they searched his searched the car, and they found heroin and some guns in the trunk. And the guy who drove the car is basically, it's all the way to the Supreme Court now. They wanted to throw it out saying that they didn't have a warrant to search his car. And he didn't give, and because, so they have to throw all that evidence out. And the government's like, well, it wasn't actually, he wasn't on the rental agreement and all this. And like, so he doesn't have the rights to that property. And so there's this argument going on amongst Gorsuch and Alito.
Right.
As to what definition of property right are we allowed to interpret here. Gorsuch wants to say that Fourth Amendment rights apply to anyone to whom has a title to the property, even if it isn't like explicit. So like the person who actually owned the property was the rental company, but right. they gave title to the person to drive the car.
Right.
That person did not give any physical title to this guy to drive it, but Gorsuch wants to say he still has the Fourth Amendment right to say you can't search this vehicle because right. I am currently, basically if you have control over property at a given moment, you have ownership
it's
over it.
Transfer
until,
of ownership.
Finders keepers.
Until someone who has a better claim to that ownership
comes
along. So if that girl with the came along or the rental company came along, they'd say, no, you get out of the car. It's our car.
Right.
But he was there. And they so Gorsuch wants to say that this property ownership exists. And yes. Alito does not, because this would be a new definition of property under Fourth Amendment law, as far as I can understand how the case is turning out. And this would actually throw out a lot of other types of these cases, and it would be a very, very big interpretive step for defining property rights. And Alito knows that, and he doesn't like it for some reason.
Yeah.
And Gorsuch does. So
because
if you're a law nerd, that's something to watch.
Because Clarence Thomas, Scalia, and Gorsuch now always were very strict originalists. And I always got the sense from Alito and Roberts that they were always going to go liberal the longer they were on the court.
Mm-hmm.
And those were both Bush picks. So, yeah, Gorsuch is definitely a huge win. I mean, somebody who's been published in the Cato Journal. I mean, he's, yeah, big win. And
for libertarians.
Yeah, and he needs to completely fill as many spots as he can. And I think that the reason Trey Gowdy is resigning from Congress is that Trey Gowdy, who is a jurist at heart, wants to be appointed to one of these court appeal courts or you know something else maybe.
That won't
Supreme
be bad.
Court. Yeah,
Judge Napolitano for Supreme Court.
Yes,
there was talks of it. With the appointment of judges like Neil Gorsuch, Amy Barrett, David Strauss, and others, he has done this flawlessly. With more than 160 vacancies, the president's work is far from done. He definitely appoints constitutionalist judges, people that respect property rights as libertarians. He also wants to protect... let me just read this, because this is great. President Trump correctly praised the constitutionalist judges he has appointed and continues to appoint. He also highlighted the defense of the right to bear arms under the Second Amendment and protection of religious liberty under the First Amendment. Things that we like as libertarians. This is something that I liked. Trump focused on economic policies that are creating an economic boom that benefits everyone, embracing workforce development and enabling everyone to realize their full potential. Therefore, he rightfully addressed legal reform that would better prepare convicted criminals to return to society, as 95% of all convicted offenders do, to lead law-abiding, prosperous lives. As America regains its strength, he said, it is important for Congress to tackle prison reform in order to help former inmates who have served in their time to get a second chance at life. The Trump administration should work with Congress to incentivize eligible convicted individuals to participate in mentoring, job skills training, addiction treatment, and other recidivism reduction programs, the Heritage Foundation says. And
first
I agree.
First step is get rid of drug laws.
Absolutely. It like later on in the speech, he talked about MS-13. And you know why MS-13 and the Latin Kings were formed is because illegal immigrants were put into California prisons based on low-level drug offenses. They were thrown into prisons with black gangs and white gangs. And In self-protection, they formed MS-13 and the Latin Kings.
It was a prison gang.
It was birthed
in prison.
All of those different gangs are fueled by the drug war.
Yeah.
And then when they finish their time, they get shipped back to El Salvador, Guatemala, all these Central American countries. And now you have narco states in these Central American countries because these gang members went back to their home country where they had no roots.
And now
they run the countries.
They're vicious.
They're as vicious as the Colombian cartels as Escobar was.
They are like psychopaths.
Right.
And I'm not just saying like, oh, they're interested in their own self-interest and they want to make money. Like, you look at them crossways, they'll cut your head off.
Yeah.
And they'll show your family and they'll kill your grandma. Like, they're crazy.
And so you know what happens? Now the peaceful people of El Salvador and Guatemala are trying to immigrate here to get out of that situation, to get away from the gangs that our drug war created. And then now we're going to shut the door on them. So Americans' policy towards drugs is asinine. And
it's
not only ruining so many lives in this country, it's ruining entire countries south of us.
Like, if we look solely at the if we look at how drugs are bad, like, what is the best reason for people to not smoke, to not do drugs? It's because they're bad. Drugs are bad. They're bad for you. They break families up. They cause addiction, and they do. But if we granted, drugs are horrible. They're not more horrible than the crime that prohibiting drugs has created.
Exactly right.
And that's fundamentally, to me, a cost-benefit analysis that I don't think it should ever be ignored, and I think is ignored to a large extent. I mean, even if we go past that, the criminalization of drugs has created a problem amongst using that just creates epidemics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the opioid crisis is I mean, I'm not an expert on this stuff, so take what I'm saying with a grain of salt, but I would not be surprised if the opioid crisis in and of itself, you could say fundamentally it is a result of the criminalization of drugs.
Right.
Like, the opioids themselves are probably illegal to a large extent. I don't know how many of them are actually got through prescription, but, like, the fact that they can't, like, smoke weed induces them to do harder drugs.
Right.
Like, they've made those connections.
No, once the Nixon administration, which Ehrlichman freely admits that to win re-election in 72, they couldn't criminalize being a leftist or a black, so they criminalized drugs.
Yes.
So then they could target black communities, black activists,
and
liberals.
This is quotes from the Nixon administration. Like,
yes.
This is actually on the record.
His
quotes.
Chief of staff.
Yeah.
Basically saying, and so once they started cutting down pot users, then cocaine rose up. So then Reagan started going after cocaine users. Then crack popped up. Then they started going after crack. And then meth popped up. And then they started going after that. And then you had the opioid addiction that we have now. I mean, it is a never-ending cycle of stupidity that we've got to get out of at some point.
And I mean, it's great that all of these states are starting to legalize.
Dude, here in Indiana, they just are about to legalize CBD oil after
yes.
a one-year and
industrialized hemp.
You are
going to drive past a cornfield now and see hemp plants growing there.
Listen,
that is going to happen.
If you are in Indiana, Gene Lysing is the Senate Republican.
And Jim Lucas is the House.
Right. But no, she is the one who will end up stopping this.
Oh.
I was talking to the Boss Hog of Liberty, who is represented by Lysing, and basically she is not in favor of the bill. And if she's not in favor of the bill's not going anywhere. So if you want industrialized hemp that could completely radically change the fortune of Hoosier farmers, where they can get three cash crops a year instead of one, then please contact Lysing's office and say, I'm a Hoosier and I'm for industrialized hemp. It's not pot. It was outlawed because somebody who owned paper interest wanted to outlaw it and used their newspapers to ban, you know, reefer madness.
Cronyism.
It's cronyism.
But
yeah.
It's, again, and I probably mentioned this before on the show, that the fact that California, Washington, Vermont now, all of these various states that have legalized medically and recreational drug use,
mm-hmm.
marijuana use, that is in outright rebellion
Yeah.
It really is. Like, it is still illegal. It's a Schedule I narcotic on the federal level. It's still illegal. And the fact that they are going, they're basically just throwing their hands up. I don't even care. We're doing what we want.
And now they've done it to two administrations in a row.
And that is.
What administration is going to stand up and stop them or support them?
I can't.
That's what is it? Which way is Trump going to go?
Oh, he's already said. Jeff Sessions is
Sessions
already
said that
he, has said. Yeah, but
Trump
you know,
can stop Sessions.
Maybe. Mm. But regardless, this guy, this situation is straight up. I mean, it's nullification, frankly.
Right.
But even if you don't want to call it that, it is absolutely in opposition to the concept of federal supremacy of law. Like the law on the federal level is that marijuana is illegal. The state law is that it's not. The states are letting people do it in the state when the feds say you shouldn't be allowed to do this by federal law. Like, it's amazing to me. And the people now the people who are supporting the most for keeping it illegal, that they're basically supporting their anti-states' rights is the right.
Right.
Like, the conservatives.
It makes no sense. Because they just can't. They're beholden to boomers who think that drugs are bad, okay? So, giving inmates a second chance, something that we're all for. Now we get to immigration. He called for an end to chain migration, which is basically, you know, your nuclear family. If you immigrate here, you get accepted here. You can bring your nuclear family.
But he claimed
that you could bring cousins and aunts, and that's not true. That was what
that would take. I think they some lawyer posted about how long it would take.
Well, he was also saying you could just marry someone and then bring them with you.
Right.
And then he wouldn't allow that anymore.
And the
because that's how people are getting around it. It's a common theme in movies. I mean, you marry someone so they can live here.
He also wants to end the diversity lottery where, listen, we have too many Brits and we need more Pakistanis, so just let a person from Pakistan in. Obviously, Donald Trump would be fundamentally... the diversity lotteries help bring brown people here, so he's not in favor of it. The U.S. immigration system gave out 72% of its green card.
Why do we have to look at it that way?
Because that's the way that it is.
Why can't it be when you, this is choosing certain minorities instead of choosing people as individuals, and that is why we should not want this policy.
What about the diversity lottery is about choosing individuals? It's about choosing people from certain countries to meet diversity quotas.
Right.
First off. Second off, when you really boil down the right's argument for building a wall, it is to keep brown people out. They don't want
to
build the wall for Norway.
Keep anyone
they
out.
Want to keep people. No.
You're not building
not
a
true.
Wall between the United States and
Canada.
And Pakistan. Or Canada.
Canada.
You're building between the United States and Mexico.
It's easier for the Canadians, literally, while we were doing this podcast, the Canadians are changing their national anthem to be more gender neutral.
Okay,
they're more likely to let terrorists in on the northern border into Canada than the Mexicans are. If you're going to make a national security argument, the diversity loving Canadians are much more friendly to people from Chechnya.
Against building a wall all the way around America?
That's a good point. You got me.
If you want him to, he's going to do it.
He will. It's going to be a beautiful wall.
It'll be a great wall. That's what he said. Great wall.
I saw Michael Che from Saturday Night Live. He's the black anchor on the Weekend Update. And if you get a chance to see him live, he's a great comedian. And he's just like, what if we like the wall? What if we like, fuck, that a beautiful wall? He's actually not as anti-Trump as you think. But he's the head writer for SNL, and he's not that anti-Trump. And Michael Che is a great Twitter and Instagram follow. He's like, what if he finishes that wall? And we just like, God damn, he made a beautiful fucking wall. So he said, let's see here. 72% of the green cards in fiscal year 2018 for family-based or diversity reasons. At the same time, the system allocated only 12% of its green cards for employment-based reasons. Galt.
So I mean, let's the immigration problem.
Let me kind of finish this up, and then we'll kind of do the whole thing. So let's see here. For some perspective, U.S. lawmakers always look at the immigration system of Canada and Australia. Those countries strongly value merit-based and economic-based immigration. In Canada, in 2016, they gave out 26% of permanent resident visas on the basis of family and 52% on economics. Australia gave out 33% for family and 67% for economic. In the past time for the U.S. to embrace It is past time for us to embrace a merit-based economic system, and that is one of the things that he is really pushing for in his
stuff. You mean capitalism?
Well, yeah. Like,
it's a merit-based economic system.
Like, can you be a producer here in this country as opposed to somebody's brother? What are your thoughts on immigration, boys?
It needs to be as easy as possible.
And why is that?
Because free trade always works and is better for everyone always and forever.
I agree.
Yep.
And the argument that I've heard against this is not a free trade argument, even though I'm sure the people who argue it are anti-free trade. It's that, oh, that's all well and good, but they don't vote right.
Right.
And it's like,
which was the Greg Lenz argument, was right. That we can let them here to be participate in
right.
Economically, but I don't want to give them the right to vote unless they're libertarian.
Right. And you know,
I mean, which
there are no easy solutions. And you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe you bring a bunch of maybe they don't like it and they vote to make everything more liberal. Maybe. Maybe, though, they also come here and they realize that all of the opportunity that they've been given is great and they don't want to lose it. And they switch. The problem is with thinking about that you can say anything about this large class of people is that you have to have a supreme arrogance and hubris to think that you know how it's all going to turn out.
Right.
And I fundamentally disagree with the idea that we should be making decisions about something like this, about the free flow of essentially goods, because labor
and
is
people.
What, yeah, people. I mean, their labor is what I'm talking about specifically. Obviously, I want them to have, you know, the cultural exchange and their own lives and all that stuff. That's all great and important. But if we're talking about it from a policy perspective, you know, everybody's always worried about labor. They want to make sure that they, like, one of the reasons they don't want them to come over is because they don't want to lose their, they took our jobs.
They took their jobs.
And we don't want them to do that and all this stuff. But, like,
yeah, I wish the right to travel would have been explicitly enumerated in the Bill of Rights,
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, they wouldn't even be able to license cars and stuff.
Right.
Right. It's
because you have a right to travel.
Great point.
You should.
Because it's not in there, they can regulate anything.
Yeah.
And libertarians, I think libertarians are actually more split on this than I think people realize.
But free trade?
Yeah. No, not free trade. Immigration.
Yeah. Oh.
Because I think there's a lot of people, the Hoppians, I would call them, that are explicitly anti-free movement of people. Like,
right.
They don't think you have any right to immigrate. And that is true under a Hoppian system, because Hoppe is an anarchist who believes that if there is no government and everything's privately owned and you have complete control over your private property, then that means no one can freely immigrate. And that's true. But we don't have such a system.
Right.
We have public property. Roads are not owned in private. Discussion as to whether or not they should be privately owned, that's over here. That's a discussion we'll table for
right,
now.
Right.
That's not what I'm talking about.
We'll get there in 200 years.
Yeah. I'm talking about the free flow of people right now across the border. That is, there is no property rights problem here if everything's owned, if roads are owned publicly. Now, you could talk about their burden on the welfare state, and personally, I'm one of the people who thinks the welfare state deserves such a burden. But
that's the best argument for it.
But no, it's
but
not.
You can, that's the best argument for it.
In 1996, in the welfare reform, they added that immigrants can't get welfare. I mean, you have to go through and become a citizen to get all the benefits of being a citizen, and that takes a dozen
and
years.
And it's also incredibly pessimistic
right,
and cynical. The idea that these people, let's say they came from south, let's say they didn't come from the immediate border of the United States where they just had to walk 2 miles and they're in America.
Right.
Let's say that they traveled from way down south in South America or southern Central America, far away, you know, like, that's not easy. Like, you can't just do that.
Right.
You have to work.
They're not in a moo-moo riding around on a one of those scooters going beep beep.
Right.
Like, get out of my way, train.
You have to work. You have to plan. You have to
float me across the Rio.
Like, it's not like they're just like, oh my God, we're going to go to the land of milk and honey that is America and we're going to live off of the government.
Right.
Like, that is cynical. That's cynical to even think that. I don't even think the evidence supports that. I'm pretty sure percentage wise, there's fewer immigrants, people who have like direct immigrants on wealth in the welfare system than white people.
It's absolutely true.
And
the Cato Institute has proven that.
And it's like,
That's not an argument. Mm-hmm. That's an argument from prejudice.
Yes.
Fundamentally, it's an argument from prejudice.
It's an argument that one time you heard from somebody and it sounded good, and so you keep repeating it without ever verifying the fact that that may or may not be the case.
But
if you were saying, I don't want immigrants to come to this country because we have a welfare state, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And when I hear that, I immediately know that our conversation is done when we're talking about immigration because you are uninformed. It is illegal for an immigrant who is here illegally to get any welfare benefits. They have to be a full citizen of the United States, and that takes a dozen years to do.
Seven years.
$10,000. It's a long process. And by and large, immigrants to this country are more entrepreneurial. They're harder workers.
They could get Obamacare. That's a welfare.
Well, okay. Cool.
That I pay for.
not anymore.
That illegal immigrants come into my country and use.
So
how are they going to get Obamacare without money? Social Security?
Right.
What?
How are they going to get Obamacare without Social Security? You're talking about they can just walk into emergency rooms?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that could happen before Obamacare.
Right.
Doctors aren't going to be like, well, you know what?
Hey, sorry about that leg that got thrown off by a train.
You got a harpoon in your chest, but you look like you might not be here legally, so I'm going to send you back.
Do you have any papers?
That's never how it's worked. Ever.
Ever. So he had a four-pillar plan on immigration and roll call. I tweeted on WAL_politics, which is a site that I basically do a lot of prep work. I put all my prep work out there. Check it out. But I retweeted these from Roll Call that night. The first pillar of his immigration plan will be offering a path to citizenship for 1.8 illegal immigrants brought to here at a young age, three times the amount of DACA.
1.8 million.
1.8 million is almost three times the amount of DACA, the what we would call DACA kids now.
And arguably that's the opposite thing that he ran on.
Exactly right. The second pillar, securing the border. That means building a wall on the southern border and hiring more border agents, Trump said. The third pillar, ending the visa lottery, a program that randomly hands out green cards without any regard for skill, merit, or the safety of our people, Trump said. And the fourth and final pillar, ending chain migration, limiting sponsorships to spouses and minor children. And if you are one of those people who think that he created chain migration as a racist term because people were brought here in chains, stop repeating that. You're an idiot. Okay, so.
Yeah, but like I was saying a minute ago, some lawyer said that to the cousin argument that chain migration, you can bring your cousins and stuff. It's actually, if you tried to bring like your cousin and your aunt, your uncle, and like, it actually would take something like 100 years.
Right.
Like to do that.
Left went crazy because he began his segment on immigration telling a story about MS-13 killing a young girl. And they claimed that Trump was trying to set up all immigrants as if they are all MS-13 as a way to persuade Americans to believe that all illegal immigrants are MS-13. And I'm sure that within a certain segment of the population, that is the case, and that may have been his intent. But I think most Americans are smart enough to know that illegal immigrants, by and large, most adults have met immigrants and have worked with immigrants and know that they're not MS-13. So stop pretending that we're all feeble-minded children that need you to protect us from the truth.
It's what they try to do with Muslims and ISIS.
Exactly.
The same thing.
So then we move on to defense and foreign policy. Trump celebrated killing off ISIS. I had printed off an article, but I didn't get a time to read it, and I want to do a more in-depth episode on if Trump actually killed off ISIS, because I'm skeptical that he was effective in anything. So we'll do a future episode on that. Then he talked about rebuilding our military as if somehow our military is decrepit and dying.
We have never cut spending to the military, like, I don't think ever. Like,
right.
I mean, for sure not since World War II, but right. I don't think ever. Like and before you bring up, what was that, 2 or 3 years ago? The
he has to appeal to
sequester.
His base.
The sequester.
Yeah.
The sequester also didn't cut spending. The sequester reduced spending growth below projected spending growth. It wasn't even like, oh, well, we knew it was going to grow this much because we had budgeted that much, and now we're going to make it grow this much. It was, the projection of the CBO was so high and the sequester reduced it below that projection, and they called that a spending cut. That's the best example of Washington speak.
Yeah.
When you reduce spending growth, that's a spending cut. And Mick Mulvaney actually has a talk where he talks about this. He says, if you reduce spending growth below the CBO estimated CBO growth, spending growth, you're still net increase in spending,
mm-hmm.
and it could even be more than inflation. That's considered a spending cut. If you keep it at the CBO growth, that's like a spending freeze. And if you increase spending growth above the CBO's projected growth, that's a spending increase.
It's a common right. lawyer trick, you know. When something doesn't do what you want it, you just redefine it. And if when you create new exactly. definitions for what things are, you create the reality.
He did say he wanted to end the sequester, which would add $500 billion to the deficit. So this is from the Heritage Foundation. Now, listen, on economics, the Heritage Foundation can be, let's say, trusted. You can listen to them and say, okay, we're in the same ballpark.
Yee-yee.
When it comes to anything military, anything interventionist, they are neocons, they are Paul Wolfowitz, they are Dick Cheney.
Wah, wah.
So I'm going to read you what they said, and I want you to know that I fundamentally read this as... The Heritage Foundation believes the same things that Trump believes, that we are only great because we have an enormous military. And that is the fundamental flaw of most people on the conservative side, is that they see our military strength as what makes America great. And I don't believe that for a second. Severe cuts, budget cuts over the last 8 years and constant deployments for the last 26 years have not been kind to the military, they say. Ship crews are tragically undertrained. Air Force fighter squadrons and army brigades are not ready. They are too small. Ready for what, Galt? The Army, Navy, Marines,
North Korea.
And Air Force are smaller today than they have been in over half a century. Well, the reason that we have less troops is because technology is better, and now we have drones.
We have more drones.
Right. Yet America's interests are under threat every day by challenges like North Korean ballistic missiles, what are the Marines going to do about ballistic missiles? The aggressive postures by Russia and China, which are just that, posturing. That's why President Trump calls to fully fund our great military. But there is a hiccup. In order for the military to actually get the funds, Congress must act. First to find the overdue agreement on 2018 defense funding, and then to approve the money that the president requests for 2019. The longer they delay it, the greater the danger to our country. We still spend more on the military than every other nation combined. We're fine. Everybody chill out. The reality is that we have less hot wars than ever before because we have the internet age has brought about greater connection between peoples of various nations and the political will for war, where in 1914, everybody's like, wait, what? I just read the newspaper. We went to war last week? Like, that's not how it works anymore. We're very much in control of our government more than they were even 100 years ago when Woodrow Wilson was in charge of the government. So,
back then they had to draft. You knew when there was a war.
You knew,
because
yeah.
Because young men had to line up and go.
Yeah.
Now there's a war. There's a war on for some control over something, and it's just fought with robots.
He and calls. Missiles. He calls to modernize.
That's
and
not true. It's fought with people too, but not nearly to the extent
not
that
really.
It used to be.
Just small squads,
right?
Not armies.
He also said we need to modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal. I'm sorry. To modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal, hopefully never to use it, but making it so strong and powerful that it will deter any acts of aggression. They say our arsenal is aging, the infrastructure decaying, the scientists retiring, and if we are not careful, our nuclear deterrent will be jeopardized. We have not tested a nuke since 1992. Our ICBMs are 48 years old, our sub-launched missiles 28 years old, and some of our bombers are 58 years old. We must invest in this critical area, says the Heritage Foundation.
So I may come down on the side of it's probably good that we have nukes.
Mm-hmm.
and it'd be nice to have modernized nukes.
I don't recreational
know.
Nukes.
I don't
nukes for your backyard.
I don't know.
We'd be real safe then.
I don't know. Now that being said, I don't know. They say it's 48 years old. That could mean nothing. They could be perfectly fine.
Right.
And it's just a tactic to get people to spend more money on it.
No, that's what they do when they buy those missiles, is the companies that manufacture them put an expiration date on them. And then they say, you can't use these after this date. You must purchase new ones. So the government gets incentive to use those missiles before their expiration date. Because it's use it or lose it, basically.
Well, I'm just saying, like, when they say our nuclear missile ICBMs are 48 years old, maybe they say there's an expiration date. But maybe it could be that they literally are just – they're not guaranteed probabilistically as safe.
Right.
So I'm not a missile expert, so I don't know. My point is that until we get to a state of affairs where we don't have – frankly, when society has advanced enough – I guess in a social and a psychological sense, that we can be assured that there won't be nuclear war.
Right.
The only deterrent to nuclear war are nukes, which sounds ironic or sounds counterintuitive, but I mean, it's, you know, it even goes down to game theory. It's like it's a Nash equilibrium. Like, it's mutually assured destruction. And, you know, I mean, it sounds really bad when you say it like that, and I know a lot of libertarians don't like the idea of governments having any access to violent mechanisms of any kind because they're the government and whatever. But for me, like, that's not the – I mean, we live in a certain world right now, and I don't know. Like, I'm not out here trying to say that we need to give more money to Lockheed Martin to just up the nuke production to 20 nukes a day or something. That's not what I'm saying. But if you ask me on principle whether or not I support the government having nuclear warheads, I'm okay with the United States military having nuclear warheads.
Sure.
I would like mechanisms to make sure they don't get misfired or something, of course.
You can argue that the nuclear age has been a more peaceful age when you compare the wars of the past 50 years to the wars of the first 50 years of the 20th century.
There hasn't been a world war since World War II.
It's certainly not been peaceful.
It's not been peaceful, right. And there has been conflicts that have spanned many countries. But, you know, I'm not an expert.
You support the global monopolization of power?
No.
That's what you're saying?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, because you're saying that you like that we have nukes and no one else is allowed to have nukes.
That's not what I said at all. I want everyone to have nukes.
Don't look at me to save you.
Oh, you want me to have nukes.
No, I want every government to have nukes.
Oh, just government to have the monopoly on it.
Right now, in the current state of affairs, yes, because no one else has an organized military.
Was it different 10 years ago?
No.
So this is an ongoing status quo.
Right now, as in the sense of we're not
in
the projected utopia that we would hope. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
I'm saying that as the reality of the world right now,
we're better off with government monopolizing control over the power. We're safer because the United States has a monopoly of force in the world.
When it comes to something like nuclear warheads, you're talking about something that can literally destroy every single human being on this planet. And the deterrent to nuclear war, and this has historically been proven true, and it's theologically true. Like I said, it's a natural equilibrium. The deterrents to nuclear war are nukes. If one person has a nuke, one group has a nuke, one state has a nuke, there is, for example, the only time I think since the invention of nukes that there was one world power that had a nuke, it was when we had two of them and we dropped both of them on Japan.
The two of you are why nobody should have nukes, because all Galt does is trigger you, and then you from orbit fire nukes at him, and then he did was send a CIA force right into your ears.
My point is
and you fired nukes at him.
My point is that nuclear warheads are like, as Thomas Jefferson would describe, holding a wolf by the ears.
Right.
Like, you don't want it to be like that, but you can't really let go.
Yeah.
Because,
man,
so
it's because they're dangerous. Maybe we should apply that same principle to weapons and guns and let only the government have the monopoly of force over
those
weapons and guns.
Don't look at me to save you. You listen, you want to argue with
no. These are arguments
that your principle is a slippery slope.
It's not a slippery slope.
It is. It is towards authoritarianism.
Because there is absolutely no device on this planet that is capable of destroying every human being and all life in general like a nuke.
Even the strongest missile, the strongest megaton TNT-based bomb.
A nuke
bomb,
still wouldn't kill the whole world. If you're exaggerating. It would destroy a city, a country, maybe a state.
Nuclear war would kill everyone.
So would ballistic missile war.
No, it wouldn't.
Yes, if everybody launched all ballistic missiles in the world, it would kill everyone.
No, it would not.
What do you think is on a ballistic missile? Nukes.
A nuke, yeah, an ICBM with a nuclear payload would kill everyone. But if you're just talking about like a TNT missile that would, they can blow up a
building. Fire all the missiles.
They could blow up a building with one of those. You think that we have so many of these missiles in the world that we could literally destroy? That's you are overestimating the amount of resources we have as like a society.
We have the largest military in the world. You don't tell me what we are capable of.
You are overestimating the sheer physics of the situation. I'm talking about nuclear weapons.
And you're saying that only governments should be allowed to have them.
No, I think that every government should have them. Maybe right now
Elon
it's only
Musk
government.
Shouldn't be allowed to have a nuke.
Right now, maybe it's only government, but at some point, yeah, maybe it could be individuals. It could be. I'm trying to say that the deterrent to nuclear war is for everyone to have nukes.
It's been a long time since I've lost control of the show,
but everyone can be us.
Right. That's okay.
Chris Spangle and you have a nuke. You're not going to nuke me because Chris Spangle's going to nuke you back in revenge.
If somebody had, you're putting me in this position of having to defend something that is that is incredibly absurd.
You put yourself in this position, sir. Because you're the one that's sitting here saying that government should have a monopoly of force.
No, you're the one. The government is a monopoly on force. The government already has a monopoly on force.
And you're defending it.
In reality.
You're saying it's made us safer than we've ever been in history.
Stop. First point. Am I defending the government as a monopoly on violence? No. I am stating that it exists, and that is the reality in which we live. Two, do I think that everyone should have nukes? Should, in like a moral sense? No. I don't think nukes are necessary in any way, shape, or form to any kind of end other than the destruction of civilization.
But you probably couldn't afford one.
Probably
so the market
not.
Would create those people that would be able to have them. Amazon, the market would automatically control those
things. Amazon nukes.
Perhaps. But do I think that given the state of affairs that we exist in our society right now, with the social political landscape that exists in this world, do I think that governments should have nukes? Yes. Every government should have them because they deter people from using them if you have them.
So then you don't want war with North Korea?
No.
Because you want them to have nukes.
Sure.
That's what you're saying.
They already have them.
I
want North Korea.
A clinically insane man that runs a country just because he runs a country. Hey, he should be allowed to have a monopoly on nukes.
You voted for him, not me.
No, I'm talking Kim Jong-un.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Donald Trump.
You're saying that because he runs a country, he should be allowed the privilege to have a monopoly of force on nukes. And every country just like that. No matter how moral, no matter how right or wrong or what political philosophy they believe in, they should have nukes, but I shouldn't.
So what you said...
They know what to do better with them than I do.
You think you're trying to say something profound and you're not. What I'm trying to describe here is literally game theory. Like, this is something that we have known that has existed for, you know, like I said, it's a Nash equilibrium. Like... It's not a matter of morality and principle. Like, oh, in this hypothetical situation, we had some clinically insane person had a nuke. Would you support that? That's not what I'm talking
about.
That's
not a hypothetical. That is happening.
North Korea has had nukes for a long time.
You don't know what they have.
Do you right now feel like North Korea will bomb the United States?
That's irrelevant.
Do you?
It's irrelevant to what we're talking about.
It is relevant because my whole argument is that bombing other countries is prevented by those other countries having nukes.
So you support North Korea having nukes.
We won't bomb North Korea and North Korea won't bomb us. That's what I'm saying.
So they should have nukes.
Yes.
You support North...
Every country should have nukes.
So I don't understand.
Because that's how you prevent nuclear war. It's counterintuitive, but it's literally...
Do you hear him?
It is counterintuitive. I completely understand. That sounds absurd. You prevent nukes. You prevent nuclear war by people having nukes. I understand that sounds absurd.
No, you're not saying people having nukes. You're saying government and nations are the only people that should have
nukes. You are conflating two issues here.
No, North Korea is a nation.
Yes, but you're trying to imply that my argument as to the ownership of nukes is limited to government.
That's what
I'm saying.
That's what's making us safer.
I said in reality, right now, governments have nukes, and every one of them should.
And because it makes us
safer.
At some
point in the future,
because it makes us safer.
Because they prevent nuclear war.
But not if individuals own them.
You're adding that on top of what I'm saying and trying
because
to present
me as
arguing.
Because you're limiting it to just government.
Because right now, no individual can have nukes. They maybe Elon Musk could. Maybe Elon Musk has the money.
Have you heard about the Boring Company? He sold like 50,000 t-shirts and he said, you know, once we sell 50,000 t-shirts, I'll sell a flamethrower.
Maybe.
And then he started selling a flamethrower like 2 days ago, and you can buy a flamethrower now.
Perhaps Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos has the resources and the wherewithal to own nukes. Perhaps. But that's not the situation we live in right now.
Because it's illegal. Because government has a monopoly of force.
I don't even know if it is illegal.
It is. To own a nuke?
I don't know.
It's got to be illegal.
Are you kidding me?
Frankly, I'm not.
There's got to be a law.
Maybe. We should have people.
They wouldn't even let that guy in Florida build a rocket to space.
We should have people look at this.
Jason.
Because I feel like it's probably like you can't like buy and sell uranium or something without a license or something like that.
Jason says that if he had a nuke, he'd nuke both of you.
I know.
It's been 230 episodes since we had a good Galt Creighton fight. I had to let him go.
But this is how it's going to make me sound insane because I'm saying that we need everyone to have nukes. And I'm well aware that it's like you're in between a rock and a hard place.
My only issue was with you saying that because only governments own nukes, that makes us safer.
No.
You said that.
No, I said because
I'll clip it.
Because,
I'll clip it and put it on Facebook tonight.
I said specifically. I'll clip it. That's fine. Specifically because governments own nukes,
they're
not going to war with other governments. That's my point. You're trying to delineate specifically my use of the word government as being an implicit rejection of private ownership, and I'm not even trying to go down that road.
But it's not even true, because not all governments own nukes.
But the ones that do own nukes do not bomb each other. The ones that don't own...
Because they're allies.
But that's not true.
Saying, I mean, for a large part, I mean, the nukes...
The United States and Soviet Union did not bomb each other. Why did they not bomb each other? Because they both had nukes. Everyone knows that.
Does North Korea have nukes?
Yes. We know that.
Yes, they do. They have 8 or 10, I think.
They have nukes.
Yeah. And you're good with that.
Yeah, because they're not going to bomb us, and we're not going to bomb
them.
They
might bomb China.
And China probably has nukes.
China does have nukes.
They're not going to bomb China because China will bomb them right back. It's mutually assured destruction. Everyone knows this.
I'm not arguing that.
But what I'm saying is that if one group, one world power has them and another world power doesn't, there is a massive reduction in incentive for that world power to not use that nuke against that country. And when that happens, all hell breaks loose. You could have world nuclear war.
So Donald Trump then went on to talk about Iran. He talked about Iran saying, when the people of Iran rose up against the crimes of their corrupt dictatorship, I did not stay silent. The people stand with Iran, and he wants to fix the Iran nuclear deal. Then he went on to introduce a $1 to $1.5 trillion infrastructure project. However, it must be noted that in broadly deriding terms, the nation's infrastructure is usually described as crumbling. He mischaracterizes it regularly. In reality, the nation's major infrastructure is in satisfactory condition. The number and share of the nation's bridges that were deemed structurally deficient, not unsafe, but demonstrating elevated maintenance needs, has declined by more than half over the last 25 years, and now represents under 10% of the nation's total. 93% of the miles driven on the national highway system are on pavement that is in fair or better condition. Airports move more people than ever before with a near-perfect safety record for scheduled commercial service. The nation's seaports continue to be among the world's largest conduits for international trade. So, in my opinion, $1.5 trillion of added deficit spending to give to cronies of Donald Trump to create monopolies to build roads that we don't really need in the first place doesn't sound like a good idea. So I'm out on that. But we'll talk more about that in future episodes,
When did it become... I asked this facetiously. When did it become out of vogue to reduce spending in one area to increase spending in another?
I don't know. I mean, really, Bush. Probably Bush.
No, I'm sure it goes way back before that.
Of course. I mean, Reagan really overbuilt the military while cutting taxes and popped the deficits up. I mean, he was really the first to really, in the modern era, to kind of pop deficits. And then Clinton brought it all under control by doing a lot of deficit control, got us to a surplus at one point. We were alive when there was a government surplus. And the wars put us into these massive deficits. And Barack Obama didn't get it under control. Donald Trump won't get it under control.
But there's this like...
And we're kicking that can down the road.
Yeah, it's because like there's this idea that deficits don't matter. So... Who cares? The only all that matters is that we can make our payments,
right?
Like, and that's not a healthy way to look at things. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not healthy. And whatever, why is it so absurd to say like if you want to increase spending on this, then decrease spending on this?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I know politically why it's hard,
right?
Because no one likes to decrease spending because everyone likes getting free money.
Yeah,
but. Like from a perspective of people like looking at this rhetorically, like why can't any either side support that? Like the like
it's not sexy.
I know it's not sexy, but I don't know. I ask it facetiously because I know that it's
entitlement is sexy.
All right, so Trump is in support of big beautiful coal. Which was the weirdest part of the speech. He was like, I have ended the war on big, beautiful coal. And the crowd went wild. They talk about pulling out of Paris and reversing Obama-era climate regulations was a dodged bullet for the American economy. Heritage Foundation for Data Analysis estimated that by 2035, participation in the Paris Agreement would produce an aggregate loss of $2.5 trillion in the U.S. gross domestic product, resulting in $20,000 of lost income for a typical family of four and a notable increase in the electricity expenditures.
I was under the impression that everything in the Paris Agreement was already U.S. law.
I don't know. I don't know enough about it, to be honest. I mean, we were doing the show when that was passed, but we just didn't spend a lot of time on it.
I was under, and I could be wrong, but I was under the impression that the Paris Agreement was more about third world countries than it was about us. We actually wouldn't have to change many of our laws, if any, to be under the agreement, the Paris Agreement,
right.
Like to be within its confines. I think it had more to do with making it so that it was third world, and maybe that's where the money would be. Is mm-hmm. like we would be required to help third world countries or something. But as far as like the environmental regulations in our society are already within the parameters of the climate agreement at Paris. I was under the impression, I mean, again, I could be wrong.
He signed an energy independence executive order that permitted fracking on federal lands, thus enabling our best and brightest, they say, to access our previously untapped vast oil and gas resources. He's capitalizing on our domestic energy. Obviously, they open ANWR in the tax bill to get it's Murkowski from Alaska to vote for the bill, and so she did. Surprise, surprise, the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank, founds that negligible changes in climate and sea levels will take place by making these changes. Eliminating the faulty social cost of carbon measures, the president alluded to unnecessary regulations that are stifling the American economy and could stall infrastructure investment. A critical component to the Trump administration in ending the war on coal, big, beautiful coal, and the war on American energy is eliminating use of the social cost of carbon in regulatory analyses. Long story short, when it comes to these carbon exchanges, and I'm not a global warming denier. Like, you can just look with your own eyes, any video, watch any climate scientist. Go up to the North Pole and watch huge chunks of Antarctica and Greenland falling into the ocean. Alaska's now starting to melt. Like,
the science is pretty clear.
The science is very clear.
The Earth is warming.
It's not even.
Oh, so Al Gore is right.
On the Earth warming, yes.
Just because the aggregate of all the temperatures have gone up.
He said we wouldn't have any ice caps by now.
Right.
There's still ice there.
But what's happening essentially is
whether
like,
or not they're right.
It's not.
Right. Versus whether or not they
it's
are.
It's not as an extreme pertinent issue as it's being.
It's still an issue.
It's yeah. But it's not something to kill yourself over.
Oh, yeah. I'm not.
Right.
There are people screeching about it.
Yeah, I believe that the climate change is real, but I don't think that it's an apocalyptic thing.
Right. So you have, I mean, you can just watch all this. It's clear that it's happening. And what happens basically is you take like the California wildfires, all that smoke, that black smoke goes up into the atmosphere and lands on the snow, and all that ash ends up in the poles, and that dark ash then starts to melt that ice faster. And so
man-made climate change is real, too.
Right.
Just so I can go on the record and say that anthropogenic climate change is real.
That black smog that you see in pollution, like in Beijing, contributes also by landing in the poles as the Earth cleans it. So we are contributing. There is no doubt. But how much are we contributing? I don't know enough about it. And so what people propose is a carbon tax, and essentially you pay a tax. And Elon Musk is for this, and I heard Elon Musk talk about it, I think, on 60 Minutes once. And this
he
is,
would be for it, though, wouldn't he?
He really, yeah, because
he's got electric cars.
Electric cars, electric batteries for homes. And that's where I saw it, on a 60 Minutes piece about it. And he's like, I'm for a carbon exchange because the only way to get people to change their behaviors is to incentivize against it. And it is not in your interest if you're being taxed on this certain type of energy, so use this certain type of energy. So that is why people are for carbon exchanges. And so when you hear people talk about, you know, the cost of American business if we enter into these agreements, that's what they're talking about. They're literally taxing CO2 emissions.
Yeah.
And that's bad for business, obviously.
I mean, my argument on this, obviously, is
but it would be good for the environment, would it not?
See, that's
which is more important, business or the environment?
It's one of those issues that I've never studied a ton about. I mean, I've never really had an opinion until I started watching like 60 Minutes advice and honestly mainstream media and left-leaning media outlets. But like Vice, when Shane Smith went up to the icebergs and you just like you see it in action, you go, oh, well, this is my eyes. These are my eyes that see what's happening here.
And yeah,
you know, like this guy put like this string and he's like, when we come back, the string will be gone. And then they came back and the string was gone because so much ice had melted. And you just go, okay. You go in Venice. They show in Venice where dry parts of Venice historically are now 150 days out of the year flooded and they have walkways. So it's undeniable that in places like Miami and New York and, you know, what are the islands that are just disappearing off of the coast of India, Venice. Across the world, the oceans are rising. How do you fix it? I'm not smart enough to know the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know really anything about the science behind it.
Right.
So, and that's the sad thing. I think that's what a lot of people get from libertarians.
Here's the thing.
There's no interest there for you to even learn about it.
My interest, I
am learning about it. I don't know enough at this point to really like make a statement of fact here.
Climate science is not some chump change thing. Like you got to go like well trained scientists that.
I just think it's an issue we're not strong on.
But what I'm trying to say is I don't know enough about it. But to me, I think that a lot of the fear comes from the concept of change in climate.
Right.
Now that being said. People who live on coasts that would be underwater if the ocean went up, however many, you know, obviously they have a big dog in the fight, and you know, projections are this, projections that I don't know, but I feel like a lot that I've heard is that climate change in and of itself is scary because it's change,
right?
And I don't like that argument, and this is an argument that I hold generally is that there's no reason that things should be stuck the way that they are.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that we should purposefully change the climate, but I also don't think that we should present it as being the end of all things either.
Nor do I think we should just say, oh, it's not real because I don't understand it.
Yeah, it's real. It's happening. Now, politically, is it more likely that you're going to radically reduce the usage of CO2, because let's face it, the biggest two CO2 emissions are electric power plants and cars, and the other, as far as man-made, the there's also natural. There's like volcanoes and decaying plants and some other stuff that cause a lot of CO2 emissions.
Mm-hmm. Cow farts
and stuff. They say you should become a vegan because so you can reduce climate change. Like, those people are so pretentious.
Right.
The way I see it is like the most visceral increase in climate, the most visceral action for climate change prevention was the advent of the hybrid.
Right.
Car companies saw that there was this big demand for people to drive not only safe and smart and fast and all this in luxury, but actually be environmentally conscious. And you
right.
can say that that's a bad reason because you're just being superficial about it. But regardless of that, these car companies saw this and they created vehicles that were more environmentally friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're not they don't get good gas mileage because there's two engines in the car. But like, if you look at the CO2 output of the vehicles, it's lower because it uses the electric battery a lot. So getting the infrastructure is one thing because that's very heavily governmentally involved,
mm-hmm.
government involved. And you can maybe have something like a Tesla battery that kind of takes the burden off the infrastructure to some extent. But I feel like the best movement we've made towards a cleaner output, a climate-friendly, change-friendly output, has been a market solution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people wanted better cars. They got better cars.
Yep.
Now, you could say cash for clunkers, and I don't think that really affected it as much as people like to think. But I think the solution to this is not going to be just taxing old industries. That's just going to cause more societal pain
right.
than is necessary. It needs to be a change that is gradual. Like, you can't just tell the coal industry and all these people who, you can't just be like, you know what?
Sorry, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah, we're going to tax you out of existence.
Right.
Like, you're like, yeah, that's going to work out well.
Or putting tariffs on solar panels.
Yeah.
It's like, why would you hurt an American industry that is going to help revolutionize? But I mean, you're doing it just to curry favor with coal miners.
Frankly, I think the biggest hurdle, like, frankly, the best solution that we have right now, until they invent fusion, for infrastructure energy that is clean and environmentally friendly and has very little CO2 output is nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest hurdles for nuclear are government regulations.
Yeah.
They're environmental protections that think that nuclear power is still from 1945.
Right.
Like, nuclear power is the safest,
the
cleanest.
Yeah. And there's a kid who invented a way to use nuclear waste to power homes with nuclear power plants on nuclear waste.
But the fact
it's completely safe.
The fact that the people who are anti-coal, and I'm generalizing, but I would argue that the people who are very vehemently anti-coal are also vehemently anti-nuclear power,
mm-hmm.
even though it is the only viable solution that could provide the output necessary to sustain our industrialized society that's also environmentally friendly.
Yeah.
Now, yes, there is nuclear waste, and there will be some nuclear waste that has to be taken care of, but you're talking about nuclear waste versus the bugaboo of climate change, because nuclear power is very clean in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very powerful, it's very efficient, it's way safer. The number of deaths percentage-wise, let alone in gross amounts, of people who worked in nuclear energy, the nuclear power plants versus coal power plants, is still ridiculously small. The worst disaster ever was Chernobyl, and that was from a failing Soviet Union using 1950s technology.
I'd argue Fukushima is probably worse than Chernobyl, and we just don't know about it.
Well, maybe.
I think they're covering
but
up a lot of
Fukushima. Was literally an earthquake and a tsunami at the same time. Like, you know, we can't.
That's the argument against nuclear is that you can't. You have one catastrophic event like that nobody foresees.
But that isn't
and
how
then
nuclear
you kill,
power. That's also not how nuclear power
poison
works.
Poison every fish in Alaska.
No, that's not how nuclear power works, though. Like, people like to think that a nuclear meltdown would literally blow up like Hiroshima or something.
No, it's
not how
it leaking of nuclear materials into the Pacific that is poisoning fish.
And it's a problem that would have to be addressed by people that are skilled and smart and have to deal with these kinds of things.
The problem is those people exist is the Japanese government's not being honest about Fukushima because they're trying to cover it up, and that makes the problem worse.
Perhaps. But I'm talking about for U.S. policy. You know, we've had the biggest disaster we've ever had was Three Mile Island, and no one even got sick from that.
Yeah.
So, like,
that we know of.
That we know of t- to this day, there have been no reported sicknesses from Three Mile Island.
It's worse than, you know, Flint's worse.
Yeah. So, like, as far as, like, a record of safety, a record of efficiency, a record of cleanliness, the only reason that nuclear power is in my mind, other than maybe lobbyists for coal and all these other electrical energy people, like, the only reason in my mind is just because people don't understand it, and it's scary. Yeah. It's nuclear. Ooh, bombs. Hiroshima, Nagasaki. So until we get fusion, which, you know, maybe that happens in 50 or 100 years.
Yeah.
I think solar. Nuclear... I think... I don't... But that's just it. Solar... The demands on solar and... And this is an important point. The demands on solar... The demands from... That we would put on solar or on wind... Would be so to literally power the entire United States electrical grid would be so intense. You talk about environmental damage. Imagine entire states filled with these, like, you can't use the land for anything other than windmills and solar panels.
Well,
you know, like,
this is happening in Henry County. The problem with wind and solar is the storing of the electricity.
Battery, and that's a general problem of batteries,
right,
that we haven't been
and
able
so
to surmount.
And so once you get the Tesla batteries, then all games
once
are
we
off.
Invent the Tesseract.
Well, there is a general problem where batteries have, since like the 70s or something, they've basically stagnated.
Yeah, we need
as far as their ability to store
technology.
Energy.
It's one of the breakthroughs we need.
All right, next up, opioids. Trump declared a war. He's going to get tougher on opioids. He's going to fix the problem by doing what we've always done when it comes to drug problems.
Arrest more people.
You know,
spend more money.
And this is one of those issues that is not on the headlines. It's sort of out there, but like the greatest rock and roll musician that everyone loves, one of the most beloved rock figures in history, just died of opioids. He's a victim of the opioid crisis, quote unquote. You know, and we look at it and go, oh, a rock star died of opioids, but he died of fentanyl. Like, fentanyl is the stuff that Michael Jackson died of.
He died from prescription opioids.
Right. And
from a doctor. Yes.
Yeah, okay. Tom Petty. And this is happening all over the country.
Moment of silence, please.
So,
the greatest rock and roll.
Wow. Definitely was.
He definitely one was. Of. So, through its Opioids Action Plan, the FDA is working to impose new requirements on manufacturers of prescription opiates. The National Institutes of Health is working with the academy and pharmaceutical industry to explore non-addictive plans. The veterans of the VA is getting involved. So,
but he did say that he was going to work on getting rid of regulations for pharmaceuticals to lower the cost of drugs too.
Right.
The try if you're going to die thing, is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's next up. So since President Trump took office, more than $1 billion has been distributed for prevention, treatment, and first responder coordination. This has largely been tagged as one of the greatest failures of the Obama administration, is that this developed under his watch and he never reacted to it. It was a huge underlying issue of the 2016 campaign. In every stop, it both Hillary and Trump said, this is the issue that I get asked about the most. And so it's just an issue that's ready to explode. And I think there's going to be, at some point, some match that will light this tinderbox that will get a real conversation about this, and there will be some action. Unfortunately, government action usually ends up in more law enforcement. And
specifically the opioid crisis.
Specifically the opioid crisis. Because what's happening now is people are cutting fentanyl with heroin. They're not doing heroin. They're doing fentanyl, the stuff that puts you to sleep when you are going under for surgery. And so they're not just doing OxyContin. They're doing stuff that's stronger than OxyContin
Majority of it's rural America.
Rural
Trump's
America.
Base.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely. But
it's not just, you can't just write it off as like, oh, black folks and Mexicans do drugs.
But I know kids, like Park Tudor here is the hoity-toity private school, high school here. There's a lot of kids at Park Tudor that are dying of heroin too. So it's a real issue.
Heroin is, I mean, these hard drugs that were always in movies and they were always in the background is like, you know, rock stars or something. Dude.
Right.
Or it was in the big cities.
Right.
Like, it's not like that anymore. Like, the hard drugs have made it into your backyard.
Yeah.
And it is, you can't, like I said, you can't just write it off as being other people that you don't know anymore, because it's probably the guy that lives next to you or down the street.
Yep.
He's probably doing it, and he's probably going to die from it.
It's a massive, massive issue. It's much bigger than anybody's talking about. Right to try. Trump stood up for the right of seriously ill patients to try experimental drugs, something they're often blocked from doing. Obviously something we're for. I mean, if you're dying, why not have the ability and the right to try experimental medicine?
Let's extend this to right to try even if you're not necessarily dying.
He said if you're terminally ill, you should not have to travel from country to country to country to try to survive.
Yep. Carly says that Diprovan was Michael Jackson's cause of death. I apologize if I'm wrong. I thought it was fentanyl. It probably was both. Then he talked about vocational education and wanting to improve school systems and 529 plans. Listen, folks, yes, we have a problem with education. Yes, we don't do enough vocational education, but the federal government has absolutely no place for education, it being involved in education.
He talked about education?
Right.
He talked about education?
A little bit at the end.
I missed that. Yeah. I didn't see him talk about education.
I haven't been following What's-Her-Face at the Department of Education. Has she been doing good?
I've heard conservatives say good things, so take that for what it's worth.
Okay.
But it's not like Jeff Sessions where everybody hates Jeff Sessions. Then he also talked about North Korea. The most troubling parts about his talks on North Korea was that diplomacy wasn't really an on the table option. So I don't like that. The things that weren't mentioned in this were deficits. Deficits weren't mentioned at all. Mm-hmm. Russia was not really mentioned. I think he mentioned them once as a competitor. But it's a smart strategic move because had he mentioned Russia, it would have been the only thing that CNN or any of these other stations covered. So
I don't think I've been on here to talk about the Russia thing. Like, in my experience, like, aren't we still just mad that they got emails that made the Democrats look bad?
That's basically the problem here.
Like, when they say Russia meddled in American elections, they mean they released private Democrat emails that make the Democrats look bad.
Well, that's one factor of a multivariate analysis.
But what else has Russia done?
So what you're saying
is... They've
bought
Facebook ads. They've made bot shill accounts on Twitter.
They drove hashtags, narratives. The did all that stuff, but like as a social media marketer, I can tell you none of that matters. What really mattered was hacking into the DNC and stealing stuff and giving it to WikiLeaks. That's what Russia did. Now, what the Democrats are always trying to find is... Did the Trump people know about it? Did they help with it? Did they tell them where to place collude?
They really want it to be Watergate.
It's very clear none of that happened, that none of these people could have done that had they wanted to. And the Mueller investigation has all been about trying to catch Trump in perjury or obstruction of justice and hoping that he's dumb enough to do either or both. And he is. And so it's been a brilliant political ploy to try and get Trump and his administration on charges to build the narrative of a scandal that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of a scandal. The problem is now it's coming back to bite them in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
This Nunez memo that we're hearing so much about, the hashtag release the memo, is some people in the administration say it's way overblown. It should have been released quicker because now everybody thinks that this is the smoking gun and it's not as exciting. But basically what Nunez did is he wrote out all the ways that the FBI screwed up in the Hillary investigation and in some ways in the Mueller investigation. And when this memo comes out, some of these House Republicans are saying this is the end of the FBI, blah, blah, blah. Some of the people who've read it say it's not that big of a deal. But the only way for us to have any clue about it, and the Democrats are, now all of the sudden, they aren't pro-Snowden. They aren't pro-Chelsea Manning.
To be fair, half of the Democrats weren't pro-Snowden.
Well, yeah, but now all of them are, because they know that it's the end of whatever's in it is going to be spun into the end of
this investigation. The implication is that Barack Obama told the FBI to spy using the power. I mean, this is probably the spy using the powers under the Patriot Act, whatever, on Trump campaign aides.
On Carter Page. Carter Page has been a known person, as it's been put, since 2014 for suspected ties to the Russian mob, to various Russian agents. And so they've been monitoring him forever. And so when he got involved in the Trump campaign, they became concerned. And as we have speculated on the show in previous episodes, the first place that you heard in the media that the Trump dossier, that the Steele dossier was used to get the FISA warrant was me speculating that that happened. And I think I'm about to be proven right, because it, by all accounts, the Steele dossier,
this is the one that was like
the P-gate, that was on BuzzFeed.
Yeah, that was totally fabricated or completely wrong.
Parts of it were, but yeah, parts of it were fabricated, like the P thing. It was you know, several dozen pages of what this former British spy was hired by Fusion GPS. Fusion GPS was an Oppo research firm founded by ex-Wall Street Journal investigative reporters. The Washington Examiner, a right-leaning website, during the primaries, hired this firm to do Oppo research on all the candidates. Well, when Trump got the nomination, Hillary had one of her law firms go and hire Fusion GPS to continue the work on Trump that they had started. And they hired this guy named Christopher Steele, who was a former British spy who had expertise in Russian affairs. And he put together this document, and basically, you know, Trump's attorneys and Carter Page and all these people had a bunch of Russian contacts and blah, blah, blah. And it was an Oppo research document. And the guy, the head of Fusion GPS, has already said that one person died as a result of this memo being leaked, which I thought was interesting for him to say. Now, you remember when we were talking about the FISA program and Snowden, we always said, what happens when the Section 702, all the PRISM stuff, all this stuff is used for political purposes? Are we about to find out, and we don't know, are we about to find out that that happened? Did a political Oppo research document, was it taken to a FISA court and authorized spying on the Trump campaign, on the phone calls, emails, text messages, communications of Carter Page, including conversations that he might have had with Trump or anybody affiliated with the Trump campaign? Was that used to spy on the Trump campaign? And what was that information used for? And where did that information go? Did Barack Obama and the security state give information and leak things to Hillary's campaign? We don't know.
Yes.
We don't know.
Yes.
So we're...
They did.
We're about to find out.
And you
out.
Know why they did, right? Because then, you wouldn't do something like that unless you knew you could get away with it.
Right.
And the polls were showing 0% chance Trump could win.
Right.
She's going to win, so we can do whatever we need to make sure she wins.
It would have never... Now, it...
Because she can cover it all up once she's in office,
now,
when she has that power.
At
she
the
can
same
make sure
time,
that never gets out.
Part of what they think is in this document are the problems with the investigation of Hillary Clinton. Now, you have Peter Strzok, who is the guy that was exchanging text messages with
McCabe.
His mistress.
McCabe.
And Andrew McCabe, who was his wife.
He stepped down just now, right?
Yeah, he just stepped down.
Because he's named in the memo. His name's going to be in the memo.
Right. McCabe was scheduled to retire in a couple months, but he sped it up. McCabe's wife was running for a state house seat in Virginia. Terry McAuliffe, who was the chief fundraiser head of the DNC during the Clinton administration.
And governor of Virginia.
Governor of Virginia at the time, donated $500,000, I think it was, to her election effort. And he didn't tell anybody that that happened for 6 months. So you have these text messages where you have... One of the experts in both, Peter Strzok helped write the Comey memo that said Hillary Clinton's off the hook. He was involved in the Mueller investigation, and he clearly was biased against Trump. That if it means nothing, it still looks really bad. And you have all of these characters on both sides, where you do have shady people in the Trump administration dealing with Russians. They're not honest brokers necessarily. And then you've got all of the Mueller team and the people in the Justice Department, where Hillary Clinton was allowed to bring her lawyer and sit next to her during question and answers. Do you think that Donald Trump would be able to go and sit, if the tables were turned, do you think Donald Trump, knowing what we know about Peter Strzok, would he be allowed to go in and be asked questions by the FBI without being sworn in? Now, you can go to jail for lying to the FBI. Like, Michael Flynn wasn't sworn in. He lied to the FBI. He went to jail. Hillary Clinton did the same thing. Huma Abedin did the same thing. None of them got charged. None of them were charged with perjury. It's all been proven that they lied about the email servers. I think the only person that got in trouble was the kid who set up the DNC server in Hillary's house, and his lawyer that represented him in that trial works on the Mueller team. Mm-hmm. So
that's one unique patch.
Is that Imran Arwan?
That's the guy in the house. He set up
the servers for the house.
Yeah.
Like, how could you ever think, like, oh, hey, I work on servers for a living. I'll end up being a political patsy.
Yeah, exactly. And you have a lot of these different connections where it's a very cozy connection between the Obama Justice Department, the Obama FBI. After 8 years, a lot of these people, you know, you can say what you want. Like, I think Robert Mueller is a man who is an honorable man. Like, I get these sense, and everybody who talks about Robert Mueller says, this dude is no nonsense. He's as nonpartisan as one can be. Like, he just wants the truth. But when you read the text messages from Peter Strzok, I can't say the same about that guy. You know what I mean? So, Jim Comey, if you read his Twitter, he's a nut job. You know, it's like reading Chelsea Manning's Twitter. It's like, I was down with you until I saw how many emojis you used, and now that's just a sign of mental illness. So, I'm out. So the memo that will be released probably tomorrow morning or early next week, that is supposedly detailing all of the ways that they messed up the Hillary investigation and the Trump stuff. Hillary was basically given counsel, wasn't sworn in, she lied to the FBI, and she was let off the hook. And then you look at the situation and you go, okay, they were going to recommend charges in July of an election year for one of the major party candidates. Like, it's the Justice Department and the FBI and the CIA, all that's supposed to be non-political.
What, does she think she's a Kennedy or something?
Right. You know, and really what it comes down to is what Galt says. None of them thought this was going to be an issue. If everything had played out the way that the Trump people thought and the Clinton people thought, none of this would be going on.
Trump didn't even think he was going to win.
He didn't think he was going to
win. Clinton didn't write a concession speech.
I don't think that anybody who tells you, oh, you don't think Trump was going to win, yeah, you're stupid. Like, there's no doubt in my mind. Like, Michael Flynn is on record saying, this is only a problem if we win. And by Trump winning, everybody, like Hope Hicks, I haven't really read into what she's in trouble for, but she's allegedly sleeping with the president. And
it really explains that breakdown you saw from the Obama officials. Like, yeah, they were all like mentally broken after they lost, because they were freaking out.
They all know.
They were like, the White House is burning down, guys.
So, right. So do you think that this is going to have anything shocking and revelatory in it, or do you think it's going to ignite a fire that leads to shocking and revelatory things?
It more that than the other. I don't think that this memo, because I don't think Devin Nunes is somebody that is a reputable character. I think that Nunes is a Republican, and I think that he's trying to make a name for himself, and I think he's willing to kind of go to any lengths, even fudging things, and that's what the FBI has said. The FBI has said that there are parts of this memo that are just completely false. What the smoking gun is, if they can get the FISA documents released, and the president has the authority to declassify those if he wants.
And he can declassify anything.
Anything he wants.
The president has above top secret. Right. He can do whatever he wants to the classification of any document that is classified as president. So
what? Remember, as we talked about a few episodes ago, when we talked about the FISA Section 702 episode, where we talked about the FISA process, they get pieces of evidence and they fill out paperwork that is about the thickness of the Cincinnati phone book and submit that, and then the judge signs off on it or says, you need to go back and fix some of this, and then they go back and tweak it and all that good stuff. And so a FISA judge is not going to authorize something unless it's pretty, especially on an American citizen, unless it's really smoking gun stuff. Like, they've got proof that this guy is a Russian agent.
How do you know that?
Here's the point.
Okay.
That's the assumption that we've all been operating under.
True.
If it comes out that they're authorizing secret FISA warrants on American citizens, warrantless wiretaps on American citizens on flimsy enough proof, like a political opposition research document that has fake stories about Russian peace stuff. Like, that's the scandal.
Mm-hmm.
That is the scandal, that the security state of the United States government was used by Barack Obama and his administration to spy on political opponents.
I mean, that's worse than Watergate.
It's worse than Watergate.
That's way worse than Watergate.
And it's absolutely true. Every bit of it.
Oh, I'm sure.
Every bit of it.
We've always assumed that.
I would like to have your confidence.
Oh.
But
so
somehow the security state always finds a way.
Oh, they may cover it up. They may cover it up.
So
we may not ever get the truth.
That right? I mean, that would be.
But
if that ends up happening, like if there is, I mean, anything's possible. Like right. Trump got elected, so like if
yeah.
if it does end up domino affecting to that revelation, I doubt it's tomorrow. Like they would have, like if it is, then they would be like, that can't be true. And
right.
They would do more investigation, and then it would be like the investigation's results would be whatever.
It took years for Watergate to fully unfold.
Right.
And
it wasn't even, they were like, you know, 18 minutes missing tape, and like
right.
they had an actual, you know, leaker, like they had a source, like a lot of things happened that other than just, you know, a memo got released.
This has been a building thing for a while.
Oh, no,
now,
yeah, but
this
isn't just one thing.
They have until January 1st, 2019 to get this done, because there's no way, in my opinion, they keep the House. If they lose the House and possibly the Senate, which I don't think is going to happen, if Donald Trump, we didn't say this during the SOTU part, but I should say this, if Donald Trump can stay off Twitter, his approval ratings are 60% right now. And if Donald Trump can completely 180 his approval ratings, then there's a chance they keep the Senate and the House. And if they do that, then this is a years-long investigation.
And then he keeps the presidency.
If they lose the House and they lose the Senate, then this investigation is done Jan 1 when the Democrats take over, because they will not have it. And you don't have the same power of oversight and investigation when you're the minority party. You just don't.
Unless you create secret warrantless courts.
Right.
And just like Obama did.
I guess...
So he still has those powers. Obama left those powers for him, so
right.
he still does.
At what point... At what point do you think that... Because not everybody in Congress knows about what happens in the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be in, like... You have to have the clearance. You have to be on the committees and stuff.
Right.
So do you think that if it does come out that there is a chance, a realistic chance, that the president of the United States was using the intelligence apparatus developed to fight terrorism to spy for political purposes on American citizens without a Fourth Amendment warrant, do you think that that would make them be like, I guess, how likely do you think that would get them to move past the politics of it being against a Democrat president
mm-hmm.
and not be like, this is too big to just ignore? Do you think that that could happen?
I think that if that's the case, if Donald Trump turns it into an issue, it's big enough for everybody to care.
Because that is probably the biggest scandal in the history of America. That's bigger than any of them. It's bigger than Watergate. It's bigger than Teapot Dome.
Yeah,
because
you're talking about with Creep. They broke into the Democratic Party headquarters and took some photos of some documents.
Right.
Like, you know, we're talking about...
This is the abuse of power. This is the blind abuse of... It's arbitrary power. Like,
right.
Nixon tried to get away with it.
Right.
But everyone was like, he broke the law.
Right.
This is literally like, you're abusing... It's legal what you're doing.
Right.
But it is
clearly
wrong.
Yeah, it shouldn't be legal at all.
This is a huge scandal.
Yeah.
And like I said, this would be bigger than any scandal in the history of the United States, in my opinion.
Yeah, they kept passing those laws, and we kept saying, this includes American citizens. And they kept saying, well, we'll never use it against American citizens.
We take our authority seriously.
Well, we need safety.
And then the reality is that it's going to be 80% of all of these warrants from these FISA courts are on American citizens.
But
it's going to be 8
right.
out of every 10.
But
it's a lot.
We joke that we're on some government watch list somewhere, but that's only because it's halfway true. Like, we probably are. Like,
I mean, remember the time when I made the joke on Facebook and put the NSA keywords when Greg was boarding a plane? They delayed it for 20 minutes and they searched his bag. Within a matter of 5 minutes, they had scanned all of Facebook for my NSA keywords and had found what flight he was on and searched his bags. Like, that is how robust it is. I think it goes so far beyond what we even can comprehend at this point. Like just the fact that Facebook Live now can scan your face and tag you automatically in a Facebook Live. You know, it did it today. It scanned the video and tagged my Facebook. Like, that's a piece of technology that we go, wow, that's really amazing. Well, what about the unseen technology of an all-powerful, no-rules, unlimited budget government that has more computing power, more hard drives, more processing power than all of Silicon Valley combined?
Yeah.
What powers do they have? And so you get one one motivated deputy director of the FBI who is working with a deputy attorney general, or two FBI agents who are as high as Strzok and McCabe are, and they find a dossier, and they are anti-Trump, and they create a story where they get a FISA warrant, and the FISA judge just says, okay, well, you're Andy McCabe. You're the deputy director of the FBI. Of course I trust you. I've worked with you for 20 years. You're a man of great integrity. This Carter Page must be really bad. Well, the judge doesn't know. He just trusts Andrew McCabe and doesn't know that he's part of this group inside the DOJ and the FBI that is ready to take him out. Now, this is all conspiratorial speculation, but it's all within the realm of possibility. This is all what everybody's trying to find out.
Yeah, that
is
or,
this what
or
happened?
The judge knows there's no accountability
right.
for it.
So it's not the Mueller investigation that – see, it started out with, we need to investigate the Mueller investigation. It's now, do we need to investigate the security services of the United States government? And that is a much bigger specter, much more frightening prospect, because what happens when we don't trust the watchmen anymore? What happens when the American people, they have such little trust in American institutions, and the one they trust the least is the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and the people that have unlimited spying? That's a dangerous proposition for this country.
You know, frankly, my opinion...
good.
The
honestly, yeah,
that would be a good thing.
Yeah. But frankly, I think that let's say that the worst comes to light and people realize this. Maybe I'm cynical, but I don't think it will have a huge effect on America, like it would on us. Like,
yeah.
I think for the politicos and the people that are attuned to these kind of things and the history people who study history and all these maybe older folks.
Right.
Like, they would recognize this as being, like, insanely bad.
Yeah.
But I don't get the impression that a large section of America would even care.
Yeah. No,
and,
I agree.
And that's sad, to my opinion.
They didn't care about Edward Snowden's revelations in PRISM. The Obama administration turned the argument to, is this person patriotic or not? Going back to what we're talking about with the kneeling.
Is he not a traitor?
Is he a traitor or not? And so it wasn't about... Don't look at the revelations. Look at, is he a traitor? You know, and I still have people who are libertarians, who are in our Facebook group, who listen to the show, who are like, why would you defend Edward Snowden or Chelsea Manning? Like, they're traitors. Like, go see the Snowden movie.
It's literally the definition of a red herring fallacy.
Right. Go see the Snowden movie by Oliver Stone. Every part of it is accurate. I lived through it. I studied it extensively. The Snowden movie is all accurate. It's a great representation of exactly what happened. When you are done, email me and thank me because your mind has been changed, because there's no way not to watch that movie and walk out of there unafraid of your government. You will be afraid of your government after you see it.
So. I'm intrigued. I remember hearing somebody on one of the members of the House said that he wished he hadn't read it because he doesn't like knowing that our government is capable of doing the things that they want now.
Yep.
Or capable of what's in that memo. Now, how much of that is just, you know, sensationalism and over the top rhetoric, and how much of it is literally that this memo, we don't know. The memo could be a freaking bombshell. Like,
yeah.
Trump could be rejecting all of the advice of his various advisors by releasing this. And, you know, I'm sure that I've read a lot of people in the House, Republicans included, House and Senate, Republicans included, have said, don't do this. Don't release this. This shouldn't be released to the public.
Is Peter King against it? Because then I'm for it. If Peter King from New York is for something. I am against it.
But like
is,
a lot, I've been watching that a lot of them are saying that don't do this. So if he does, if this is a bombshell, and it does, I mean, yeah, that if it shows that the president of the United States used his authority under the Patriot Act to spy on political opponents or on behalf of a political ally for.
It won't implicate Obama.
Well,
it won't be that big.
I don't know. How else could you get around it?
Okay,
the administration. Okay, yeah. So did the, it'll never, did ever the Obama be put on administration, Obama. And then it'll be what did you know and when did you know it? But yeah, if that happened, I mean, that is the biggest.
Think about it. Everybody says, oh, he was scandal-free. No administration is scandal-free. You have Fast and Furious. You have Benghazi. But, like, those are very minor scandals compared to, like, I don't know, starting a war in Iraq or on false intelligence or Watergate. So,
but, yeah, that would be the – if that comes to light, that would be the biggest scandal in my
terrorist
in the
attack.
History of the United States. There would be there could be nothing bigger than that.
All right. Let's wrap up. Final thoughts for this episode. Chris Galt.
I think we have a lot to look forward to. I think for the first time in a long time, we have a government where we don't know what will happen tomorrow. And that in previous administrations always meant that something bad will happen tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But for this one, I think for the first time in a while, we can say something good might happen tomorrow. It's not all bad for the first time in a while. I don't know. I'm pretty optimistic, guys. That's why I came in here smiling today.
When Chris Galt is optimistic.
And it's great. Whoa, Mittens.
Mittens just took out the mic. She's excited, too.
But, yeah, I don't know how anyone can really just hate on all this as a libertarian. I think it's great.
Creighton.
Progress.
I was addendum to the previous topic. It frankly, it's not surprising if the FBI abused their authority, because if you know, if J. Edgar Hoover was in charge of the FBI at one point, I mean, like, if that guy could be in charge of the FBI,
dude.
Like,
read that Onion title, the Onion from
okay.
today.
All right,
that was so good.
Go ahead.
Huh? Oh, I mean, other than that I mean, as far as Galt's optimism, I am. My priorities since have shifted to where now I'm less interested in the specific happenings of day-to-day politics as I am in the long term of what society looks like. And that's just a fancy way for me of saying that I don't read my Facebook news feed every second of every day anymore. And I started reading things other than political treatises. So... But yeah, I treat Trump like I've treated anybody. I don't like him on a lot of things, and I like him on some things. Or maybe a lot of things. I don't know. I'd have to go down and count them. But like, I like him on some. I don't like him on others. As far as the politics of his supporters, I don't like some. I do like others. So like, you know, everybody. The world is a complex place. So, I mean, I try and keep myself grounded. When it comes to judgment of political peoples.
What?
That's also why I don't believe that 9/11 was Bush, so.
Why do you got it? We're almost out of here. What are you doing? All right. This is from The Onion. Great headline today. FBI warns Republican memo could undermine faith in massive, unaccountable government secret agencies. The FBI Director Christopher Wray says, making this memo public will almost certainly impede our ability to conduct clandestine activities operating outside any legal or judicial system with an international scale, noting that it was essential that mutual trust exist between the American people and the vast, mysterious cabal, given free rein to use any tactics necessary to conduct surveillance on U.S. citizens or subvert religious or political groups. It's a great, great article. Thank you to Brandon Luke, Christy Avery, Jason Doolittle, and Craig DaCosta for being our $100 a month subscribers. You guys are awesome. Thank you all for listening to this episode. It was a long one, so if you're still here, you're one of the true fans. We appreciate it. Why? What?
And as always, next time.
Did you two plan this ahead of time?
But he didn't do it.
This is the first I'm hearing about it.
Okay.
What's the go word? I don't know what the go word was.
And as always, we promise.
Do better next time.
There you go.